I'll move the adoption of the minutes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Vickerman. Senator Vickerman moves that the minutes from the hearing of Wednesday, March 28th, be approved. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Motion, the motion prevails. I would remind people who are here to testify on bills and to observe the committee that there are committees that are operating simultaneously with this one, where members of this committee, this side, with the exception of Senator Pappas, are either presenting bills or have dual committee meetings at this particular time that are extra meetings. We have before us then Senator Pappas, Senate File 1075, Investment Board Sudan Holdings Divestment Requirements. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for holding this hearing today. I think I don't need to talk about probably the genocidal situation in Darfur and northern Sudan, but although one of my witnesses will talk about genocide in general. But this is a way that we who often feel helpless in international conflicts can have a direct impact on what could happen in Sudan. What this legislation does is it requires the State Board of Investment to engage with and divest from what we call scrutinized companies that operate in Sudan and either directly or indirectly support the Sudanese government's ability to carry out genocide. The bill sets out specific criteria for identifying these scrutinized companies and assembling those companies on a scrutinized companies list. The bill requires the State Board of Investment to assemble the list, identify the companies that are held in their portfolio, and engage with these companies regarding their business practices in Sudan. If the companies are unresponsive during this expedited engagement period, I believe it's 90 days, the legislation requires the SBI to divest from half of those assets within 12 months of passage and all of the assets within 18 months of passage. Senate File 1075 builds in specific protections for investment returns. Difficult-to-divest assets, including private equity and actively managed commingled funds, are excluded from divestment. The bill allows the SBI to cease divestment if it were to lose more than 5% of the value of its portfolio. The bill also builds in a sunset clause allowing divestment to cease when the federal government deems the genocide has ended or economic sanctions are no longer necessary. This is not just targeted divestment is not just a symbolic gesture, but it is an effective tool to stop the genocide in Darfur. The Sudanese government is heavily reliant on foreign investment to carry out its campaign of genocide. 70% to 80% of the revenues the government receives from oil are spent on military expenditures. This government is very responsive to economic pressure, and it has already begun to respond to the current divestment campaign. Yet Minnesota needs to add our voice to the growing chorus of cities, states, universities, and private investors who refuse to invest in or profit from genocide. This is the most powerful tool we have to stop the first genocide of the 21st century. Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce Ellen Kennedy from the Genocide Intervention Network.
Ms. Kennedy, if you would identify yourself, please, for the record. We'd be pleased to have your testimony on this bill.
My name is Ellen Kennedy. I'm a professor at the University of St. Thomas and at Carleton College. I'm also the state coordinator for the Genocide Intervention Network. I went to Rwanda in 2005, and I met a young woman, Alice Musabende. When Alice was 14 years old in 1994, her mother sent her to the next village on an errand. When Alice returned home, she found the mutilated bodies of her grandparents, her parents, her 12-year-old sister, and her 9-year-old brother. This past Monday, April 9th, was the 13th anniversary of their death in the Rwandan genocide. I've been to Turkey. 1 million Armenians were killed in that genocide in 1915. I've been to Auschwitz, a concentration camp in Poland during World War II. 6 million Jews were killed in that genocide. I've been to Cambodia. 2 million Cambodians were killed in that genocide in 1975. And I've been to Rwanda, where nearly a million people were killed in 100 days in 1994. Stalin once said, "A single death is a tragedy, a million deaths a statistic." Yet the deaths in Darfur, nearly 400,000 of them, are indeed a tragedy, each and every one of them. This coming Sunday, April 15th, is Yom HaShoah, the Day of Remembrance for those who perished in the Holocaust. April 24th is the Day of Remembrance for the Armenians who perished in that genocide. We memorialize the victims of genocide instead of ending genocide. It is time to say that we will take a stand against these horrors, and I urge you to pass this divestment bill. We can have an impact at the state on the international responsibility to protect innocent civilians. Rabbi Stacy Offner, former chaplain to the Minnesota Senate and rabbi of Congregation Shir Tikva in Minneapolis, chairs the Socially Responsible Investing Committee of the Reform Pension Board of the United States. 2 weeks ago, this national board passed a resolution to divest from investments in companies identified by the Sudan Divestment Task Force. The fact that Jews around the world are standing up against the genocide of Muslim brothers and sisters must be a moral inspiration for us all. Rabbi Offner is unable to be here this afternoon. She asked me to read the text of that resolution. Whereas Judaism teaches that all human beings are created in the image of God and are commanded not to stand idly by while our neighbor bleeds. Whereas the Jewish people are intimately acquainted with the horrors of genocide. And whereas current events in the Darfur region of Sudan meet the United Nations definition of genocide, and whereas the Senate and the House of Representatives and the President of the United States have found that the government of Sudan bears responsibility for massive atrocities in the Darfur region of Sudan, which they declare have reached the level of genocide, and whereas the Sudan Divestment Task Force identifies companies that provide revenue to the government, impart minimal benefit to the countries underprivileged, and have expressed no significant corporate governing policy regarding the current situation in Darfur, be it resolved that until such time as the Sudan government stops its policy of genocide, this board directs its investment managers to divest any and all investments in companies identified by the Sudan Divestment Task Force as soon as possible. I urge that we in Minnesota take a similar stand and lend our voices to those national voices urging the protection of innocent civilians in Darfur. I especially want to thank all of the students who are here representing the University of Minnesota, Carleton College, Augsburg College, and the University of St. Thomas for supporting this important effort. I particularly want to commend Lubakare Matayo, a refugee from Sudan, for his advocacy on behalf of his friends and loved ones in Sudan. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kennedy. Senator Pampas.
Madam Chair, we do have a couple students I'd like to just make a brief statement.
Certainly.
We can start with Mr. Niebuhr. And Christy, do you want to come up here too?
If you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
My name is Ben Niebuhr. I am a resident of Fridley, Minnesota. I am a student at the University of St. Thomas. And moreover, I am a refugee. It is with this latter title that I greet you all today. As a survivor of the Liberian Civil War, I understand how it feels when the world turns a blind eye to the plight of your people. I can still remember being carried long distances to safety on the back of my uncle. I also remember, all too well, the fear of being different from the powers that be and the oppression that different entails. Because of this experience of oppression, I identify with the millions of Darfuris who have suffered and continue to suffer at the hands of a xenophobic government. As a result, I feel compelled to take a stand and work for their rights to be free from oppression. Furthermore, as a student of conflicts and their resolutions, I completely agree with Harvard professor Samantha Power when she writes, "American policymakers, journalists, and citizens are extremely slow to muster the imagination needed to reckon with evil." End quote. Fortunately, I see Senate File 1075 before you today as one very innovative and effective way in which the state of Minnesota can reckon with the evil that is genocide. Thus, I plead on behalf of the Darfuri refugees in Chad and the millions of internally displaced people in all of the Sudan that you would pass this divestment bill and in so doing lend a hand in solving a problem from hell.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nebo. Senator Pappas.
Hi, my name is Christy Dolph. I'm a student at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities and a member of the University Chapter of STAND, which is Students Taking Action Now Darfur. I'll be very brief. I just wanted to say that last week, the University of Minnesota Senate, which includes faculty, student, and staff representatives from all four of the university's campuses, voted overwhelmingly in favor of a Sudan divestment resolution similar to the one you were considering today. Now the university is awaiting a response from its administration, but is on course to begin reviewing its investments and decide, according to the recommendations of the Sudan Divestment Task Force, where they need to divest. I mention this today because the ability of the divestment campaign to influence outcomes in Sudan grows every time a new institution takes a stand. And it is only by the cumulative action of individual universities, cities, and state governments that this divestment campaign will be effective. The passage of 1075 would make our own divestment efforts at the university and at other institutions of higher learning more meaningful, and vice versa, because then we are all working together towards a common goal. And by proceeding on a unified front together, the public institutions of Minnesota will also strengthen the national movement to stop the genocide in Darfur via targeted divestment. For these reasons, I urge you to support SF 1075. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Senator Pappas?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did want to mention that there are about 8 states that have policies on divestment. Iowa and California have both passed this approach, this targeted divestment approach. Vermont, their pension board made the decision to divest. Colorado and Rhode Island, the divestment bills are on the governor's desk. It's expected that he will sign them, and it's pending in 15 other states. So this is very much a national movement. Then I'd like to introduce Mr. Scott Weiser from the Sudan Divestment Task Force for his comments, and he's also here to answer any kind of technical questions that people might have about the legislation, how it's going to work.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Mr. Weiser, thank you for appearing today. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Scott Weiser. I'm the Senior National Field Organizer for the Sudan Divestment Task Force, which is a project of the Genocide Intervention Network. As the speakers have said, genocide is taking place in Sudan. This represents the first time in history that the President and Congress have declared a genocide while the atrocities are ongoing. 400,000 people are dead, 2.5 million displaced, 4.5 to 6 million in desperate need of humanitarian aid, and the situation is rapidly deteriorating. It is because the international community has been unable and unwilling to deal with this genocide that we turn to the states to take important action to pressure the government of Sudan economically to stop this genocide. I want to briefly speak on divestment and targeted divestment as an effective tool in this case, and then comment on the minimal financial impacts that this would have for the State Board of Investment. The Sudanese government is deeply reliant on foreign investment. This is a government that carries a debt burden as large as its GDP, yet is predicting 13% economic growth in the coming year. That is because of foreign investment in the energy sector. As Senator Pappas noted, 70 to 80% of the revenues that the government gets from oil goes to the military expenditures. Now, that should be a disgusting number for any government, but it's particularly atrocious when that is used exclusively to murder innocent civilians. The Sudanese government is very responsive to economic pressure. In 1997, under President Clinton, the United States government issued an executive order sanctioning all U.S. companies from operating in Sudan, with exceptions for social development companies and humanitarian work. As a result, Sudan immediately changed their policies regarding terror. Osama bin Laden was kicked out of the country, terror camps were cleared out, and a number of suspects were detained. As well, the Sudanese government began to share information with the United States. A divestment campaign against Talisman Oil, a Canadian oil company with a large share in the Sudanese oil game in the late 90s, eventually resulted in the Sudanese oil company, in the Canadian oil company leaving Sudan, which was a very influential factor in the government in the north, which remains there today, agreeing to negotiate with the south to end the 20-year civil war that took over 2 million lives. So these are two instances in which we see economic pressure being very effective with this government. As Senator Pappas noted, this is a national campaign and, in fact, a global campaign. In addition to 8 states already implementing divestment policies, up to 18 other states are currently considering these policies. We also have legislation pending at the federal level that would endorse state divestment. We have active campaigns in Canada, England, Ireland, and are working to spread to Europe. As a result, companies have begun to react. ABB Limited, a large Swiss company, recently announced that they would cease all non-humanitarian operations. Siemens, a large German company which had over $30 million of revenue in Sudan in 2006, said they would cease all non-humanitarian operations in Sudan. Now, the moral problem of operating in Sudan existed in 2003, 2004, 2005. So why are companies changing their behavior now? Because they see the divestment campaign coming, and they want access to U.S. capital. Minnesota has the opportunity to place deep economic pressure on the government of Sudan, and that has a real power to be the tool that stops the first genocide of the 21st century. I'd also like to note that the divestment campaign has the ability to impact other governments who have been reluctant to interfere in the Sudanese government's ability to carry out genocide. Notably, China, which has a large interest in the oil game, has gone to extensive efforts to get access to U.S. capital markets. And if we begin to drive the share price down on state-owned oil companies operating out of China, the Chinese government will certainly take note. To briefly cover the financial impact for the State Board of Investment, by the targeted nature of this legislation, it's likely that there will be roughly 24 companies on the scrutinized companies list that would be assembled by the State Board of Investment. Of those, it's possible that the State Board of Investment would hold up to 12. In many other states, and I don't yet know the numbers for the State Board of Investment here, we see that being about 0.3% of the portfolio. This money just needs to be shifted elsewhere. Since it's not sector-wide divestment, you can continue to invest in similarly situated companies, just those companies that don't operate in Sudan. So if you find that a Chinese oil company is operating in Sudan, you can move to some other emerging market energy concern, which would be equally profitable and similarly situated. I'd also like to note that the legislation you're looking at is constitutional, and one of the ways it remains constitutional is by allowing the pension boards to protect their fiduciary duty. We exclude actively managed commingled funds as well as private equity since those assets are particularly difficult to divest and wouldn't have great impact on the government of Sudan. We've also made it so that the legislation is constitutional in that it benchmarks to the federal government. When the federal government declares the genocide over, divestment shall cease. Any companies exempt from U.S. federal sanctions are also exempt from this legislation, so it's certainly constitutional. This legislation has been endorsed by a number of groups, including Human Rights Watch, the International Crisis Group, members of the Minnesota delegation who have signed on to the federal divestment legislation, as well as a number of groups here in Minnesota. I thank you for the opportunity to speak here today, and would be more than willing to answer any questions you have regarding the legislation.
Well, thank you, Mr. Weiser. Are there comments or questions for Senator Pappas or her witnesses at this point? Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Pappas. I'm wondering, I am a new member of the Pensions Commission, have not served on it prior to this, just the last couple of months, and I'm wondering if this issue has been raised in previous years of the Pension Commission and if that discussion has occurred from a pension policy perspective and if there's any intention to go to that venue to have additional discussion about the impact on the State Board and our pension situation in Minnesota.
Madam Chair and Senator Larson.
Senator Pappas.
No, the discussions have been with the State Board of Investment. That's who we've been discussing. And I did pass out letters from both the governor and the Secretary of State just to show people that there is interest in the State Board of Investment and support for us to move forward and do legislation.
And Senator Larson, we are going to be hearing from Mr. Becker.
Thank you.
Are there other questions or comments for Senator Pappas or Mr. Weiser or her witnesses? Seeing none, Mr. Bicker. Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Howard Bicker. I'm the Director of the State Investment Board. What I would like to do today is basically tell you what the State Board of Investment has done as it relates to the issue in Sudan. I do have copies here of a resolution that the State Board of Investment passed at its December meeting that relates to the potential financial risk that companies are having as it relates to their continued operations in the Sudan. A number of the steps in the that are laid out in the board's resolution are not dissimilar to the legislation that has been proposed. It calls for the establishment of a list. It calls for us to have constructive engagement with these companies. It calls for us to have contact with the money management organizations that the board has retained that have made these investments for us. And then after the list has been established and we have made contact with the companies and the firms that manage money, to have all this information put together and have the proxy committee and the staff of the State Board of Investment make additional recommendations to the board. And these recommendations could include a number of things, including additional meetings with management. It could relate to various shareholder resolutions and proxy. It could lead to us working with a number of other public entities. And it could even, for that matter, lead to some divestment recommendations. But what the board's resolution does is basically follow the same steps as the proposed legislation, but does not predetermine the outcome of that analysis from a financial perspective. So, Madam Chair and members, the board has taken steps and is in the process of working towards whatever financial ramifications that we can analyze as it relates to companies doing business in the Sudan.
Thank you, Mr. Bicker. Are there questions or comments for Mr. Bicker from the SBI? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bicker, it was mentioned that this would involve 1/3 of 1% of the current State Board of Investments investments, and I'm wondering, is that a figure you agree with?
Mr. Bicker?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, we have not finished that list. First of all, it will not include any U.S.-based companies because they are already prohibited from doing business by congressional and presidential actions. So it's only our international component. We don't know exactly what those numbers are, and I don't know whether it's going to be 1/3 or 3%. It's not going to be 50%. It will be a relatively small number, but we do not know exactly what that number is.
Senator Roebling.
Are there similar investments that could be made to replace those if you withdraw from certain investments that are engaged in the Sudan?
Mr. Bicker?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, I don't mean to be evasive, but we have not established that list yet. That will be done, and it's being in our schedule. That will be brought to the board's next meeting, which will be in June. Once the board has established the list and approved the list that the proxy committee and staff will be working on, then we will have to look at these companies. Again, the board's resolution does not necessarily call for immediate divestiture, so that's not one of the things that we are looking at this stage. We are looking at what is the financial ramifications of continuing doing business in the Sudan. And there are a number of problems, potentially, for doing business in Sudan, as has been suggested, for example, of access to the capital markets. A lot of people are very reluctant to do business with organizations that have various potential risks. So those are the things that we're going to be looking at over the next 6-9 months. And we are not looking for replacements at this stage because that's not necessarily called for in the board's resolution. The board's resolution is to do analysis of the financial risk of these companies. We have not completed that. The proposal that's in front of you, Senate File 1075, does lay out a very specific list of things that must happen, and if they don't happen, then they will be sold. If that was to happen, then we would have to start looking for alternatives, but we have not done that yet.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I certainly appreciate Mr. Bicker's work and the work of the Board of Investment, but I do feel a sense of urgency here, and that this whole issue of divestment was brought up last legislative session. Senator Bonoff carried the legislation. The compromise with the board was the resolution, but it did take from last spring until December before they passed the resolution. They did have a meeting a couple of weeks ago. They could have had a list of companies at that time to scrutinize. They've delayed until June. I just think that our legislation would move things along, and there are resources, there are people available that can help assemble the list of companies. That's, other states have done this. It's not rocket science. It's possible to do in a relatively short period of time. And I don't want to accuse them of delaying, because I don't know if they're delaying, but I do think that we could move a little more quickly. And I would like to ask Mr. Weiser if he would make some comments, too, at this time.
Yeah. So if I may briefly comment on the issue of assembling a list, one of the things that the Sudan Divestment Task Force does is try to make this as easy to implement for states, universities, cities, and private investors. We've assembled a list of companies that is designed to meet the criteria set forth in this legislation. It specifies which companies would be subject to divestment and those which would be subject only to engagement. That list has been certified by the Calvert Group, which is the largest socially responsible investing firm in the country, and therefore that should lend some financial credence to anyone who questions the authority of the list. Certainly, pension boards are allowed to use other lists. They can contract with private research firms to do this work. That list is available. I believe that the State Board of Investment has it, and they can certainly use that to identify where the holdings would be. Regarding whether or not we need legislation to move this question forward, I think that we absolutely do. If you are a company who's doing business in Sudan, mandated divestment legislation is a far greater threat than a resolution which asks someone to consider whether or not you're financially risky. While I agree that it is financially risky to do business with a genocidal government, it's also morally problematic, and so we can't let financial risk be the only reason that we would divest from these companies. We also should divest because it has the power to stop a genocide, and I don't see that in the State Board of Investment's resolution. I do see that in this legislation. I also believe that mandated legislation builds in protections for the State Board of Investment insofar as members who have pensions with the State Board of Investment and Minnesota constituents may want to press the State Board, why haven't you done this already, or why are you doing this so quickly? Whereas if the legislature makes the decision for the State Board, it sets out a clear timetable, and the State Board has a directive, and if someone brings up concerns in the future, they can say this was a legislative decision, and that was where this was dealt with. I think that the letter that you have from the governor indicates that that's also his perspective. I also wanted to briefly comment on the availability of other companies. And I noted this in the testimony, certainly the State Board can't comment on where they would move the money since they haven't assembled the list, but it does turn out to be the case that you're looking at a very small subset of the investable companies that are out there. So as I said, in other states, and we don't know the numbers here yet, we're looking about 1/3 of 1% of the holdings. And so if one in other states, and so if one company that is operating in Sudan has problematic operations, you can certainly move to other emerging market companies that just don't happen to be in the Sudanese oil game.
Are there other comments or questions for Senator Pappas? Senator Pappas, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, if there's no other comments, then I would move that Senate File 1075 be recommended to pass.
You've heard Senator Pappas's motion. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, we have Senator Pappas's motion that Senate File 1075, there are no amendments, be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very
much.
Thank you
very much, Madam Chair and
Senator
members.
Senator Pappas. Senator Youngbauer, we're going to start with your bill. When Senator Scheid arrives, we may lay it aside so that we can have her bill because she has a medical appointment.
Okay.
Senator Youngbauer, Senate File 2043. Also, as we are beginning that, I would like to thank the university students for coming today, and you have a very important presence as part of this process, and thank you, Senator Pappas, for inviting them.
Madam Chair and members, I do have an author's amendment to Senate File 2043, the A1 amendment.
We have the A1 amendment, which is a delete everything amendment. Senator Roebling moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Youngbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I do have testifiers here today, but I've explained to them that as we get towards the end of our deadlines, that I will just let the committee direct any questions they might have, but I'd like to introduce them. From the HRA of the City of Anoka, I have Mary Elvig. From Planning, Jim Cook. And from the Charter Commission, Dave Bonthas and Chuck Drury. So they would answer any questions we might have. But members, what we have today is an issue in the City of Anoka and actually dealing with Minnesota Statute 469.003. And when you really read through the statute, it almost looks like there's a little void within the statute. What that does under Subdivision 6 is allows a mayor, with the approval of the governing body, in this case a city council, to appoint members to the HRA. In Anoka as well as in other areas, and it kind of works like this, members the same way as the governor appointing commissioners and then the Senate okaying, approving those appointments. Well, within the City of Anoka, we have some vacancies, some expired terms on the HRA, and the City Council has chosen not to approve these people trying to get some new members on the HRA. There's actually five people that have applied for the positions, and the mayor not letting any of those move forward. So we're kind of at an impasse, and members, in dealing out in the community, the only person I can find that's against this proposal today is the mayor, who wants to take a little control here. There's a lot of issues within the HRA that need to move forward now in terms of bonding and some specifics that these members of the community can talk about. But really what this A1 amendment in Senate File 2043 does is allows the City of Anoka to put into its home rule charter the procedures for if the council does not approve those names put forward by the mayor, then the mayor would have to then put forth some new nominations.
So, Senator Youngbauer, what you essentially have done is to take a general law proposal and make it specific to the City of Anoka, making it special law, non-codified.
Yes, that's what we've done, Madam Chair. And I believe that we really, down the road, need to go back in and make that provision within the statute for everyone because, you know, though we might think there shouldn't be politics played within individual cities and here at the legislature as well, sometimes there's a butting of the heads, and this would move things forward until the proper people were appointed.
Maybe, Senator Youngbauer, you can deal with the experience of Anoka, and maybe later on a general law provision might be appropriate. Are there questions for Senator Youngbauer?
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Vickerman.
We haven't moved to the A1 amendment, have we?
Yes, we passed it.
Okay.
Yes, we have adopted the delete all amendment. Senator Roebling moved that. Are there questions, or does anyone need to hear from the witnesses from Anoka? Seeing none, Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 2043 43 be recommended to pass and be referred to the floor?
Yes. Senator Youngbauer, Senator Roebling moves that Senate File 2043 be recommended to pass. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill at this time? Seeing none, we have the Roebling motion that Senate File 2043, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Youngbauer. We're going to accommodate Senator Scheid at this time, and we'll come back to your bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Scheid, you bring Senate File 2127, State High School League Rules becoming subject to the Administrative Procedure Act.
Madam Chair, I do. And members, I know that everybody has, well, probably everybody sitting here in this room has heard about the Minnesota State High School League and the new rule, or the change in the rule that was adopted in March officially by the league and will have effect, I believe, beginning with the 2007-2008 school year. And I had a bill that came very close to passing in the Education Committee that would have undone that rule. The rule is that, the rule that they're operating under this year before the rule change was that students who transfer under open enrollment were allowed a one-time exemption so they could just continue to play whatever sports they were interested in one time. But they couldn't go back and forth to schools. They couldn't use that exemption again. I think they would have been precluded then from playing for a year if they had tried it a second time. But the high school league said that all students between 9th and 12th grade who transfer under open enrollment will be prevented from playing in a varsity sport at the school to which they're transferring. They've said, well, they could continue to play in a sport at the old school while they transfer to the new school. That's probably not real practical for people who, because you understand under an open enrollment, you have to provide transportation to get to the to another district. You're responsible for your own transportation, so getting back and forth to practices and to the new school isn't real practical. And so, or you wait out a year, or you can play JV if your school has junior varsity, but you may not play. Now, over 14,000, in fact, it's almost 14,500 students from between 9th and 12th grade use open enrollment. I believe that's a current figure. That's between 9th and 12th grade. Of that number, only 765 applied to participate in any high school league activity this year. That the rule has covered debate, one-act plays, that kind of participation as well as athletic. No question, probably most of those 765 were playing an athletic sport. But they may, there's nothing to suggest, frankly, what percentage of those transferred strictly to play on a high-profile super team. And I'd be really interested to know about any super teams that won high school championships this year. I don't know if a lot of students transferred to Buffalo High School, for example, Senator Rest, you know, since we were cheering for another school in that contest, yeah. But even, well.
Senator Scheid, I wonder,
I just wanted to give you background. So now, that
thing about why they should be.
I just wanted you to know that's the underlying issue.
They should be subject to the APA.
Right. When the legislature authorized the high school league's activities in statute, and it's chapter 128, 128C.
128.
Because I will tell you that when I introduced the other bill and this one, I've gotten calls saying, well, what right does the legislature have to be monkeying around in the state high school league business anyway? Well, they're a creature of the state legislature, and they have statutory authority. And I believe in the last couple of years we've given them authority. I believe they collect sales tax on ticket admissions but do not have to, similar to the state fair, do not have to remit it to the state. So they're getting tax dollars as well. And I think they do a wonderful job. The tournaments this year ran beautifully, and I think they do a very fine job of that. In discussion of the first bill, it was discussed, or it was mentioned by Mr. Aronson of the High School League, that the state of Michigan had adopted a similar kind of rule that they have just now adopted, which precludes participation in the first year at the new school in a varsity sport. But he thought that we would be similar to them. Probably they had about 275 waivers, I believe I'm quoting him correctly, in Michigan. And he figured that, he told the committee, he thought that that's what would happen in Minnesota as well. That's no way to run a rule. I really don't believe that it should be by waiver. I think the rule should apply and do is the least amount of damage. If 275 waivers are issued, how many parents or students didn't know what they had to do to get a waiver or didn't understand how to do that? That's just, I think it's just wrong to run a rule by waiver. And I think that's my underlying reason for having this legislation, is to say, you know, let's do a rule, let's do it right, let's do it according to Chapter 14, administrative rulemaking process, and there are guidelines. You'll see the repealer language describes what the process should be now for the high school league, but we did, in fact, exempt them from Chapter 14 rulemaking procedures, so that's what my bill would do, is just put them under Chapter 14 for rulemaking. And, of course, it also then, it's not retroactive other than if 100 people ask them to revisit a rule, you see the language says that they would then have to go back and redo it through Chapter 14.
Senator Scheid, I notice in the repealer that there was a 100 person standard for requesting a public hearing before an administrative law judge, and I wonder why you changed that language to just 100 or more people. Wouldn't you want on line 110 there these 100 people to have some sort of standing rather than just, 100 people random petitioning, walking down the street?
Madam
Chair.
Why
did you change that line?
Madam Chair, and of course I did not write it, but I believe if they would be required to follow Chapter 14, and I think that would be required then under Chapter 14. I could be wrong.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, I think the question is why people, why not parents, as in the original
legislation. I'm sorry.
Mr. Bodderin informs me that under Chapter 14, the standard is 25 people, and they could be from anywhere. But I wonder if in this particular instance you really are trying to address parents and guardians' concern, or maybe not, but if so, why 100 rather than what Chapter 14 calls for, which is 25?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy with 25. I'm sorry, I didn't.
Mr. Bodderin, would you give us a little bit more explanation? And this particular one says, is it true that, her 100 people would be would force the league to readopt a rule adopted before the effective date of the section following Chapter 14. In Chapter 14, are there petitioning sections which say that the given agency or entity would have to readopt a rule upon petition?
Madam Chair and members, you're absolutely right. That's a different nuance that I'm not familiar with in Chapter 14. Okay. I think I was thinking generally that the standard in Chapter 14 for requesting a hearing is 25 persons, and it could be the reference to people here was intended to track that. But certainly it's a different circumstance when, in effect, the rule will be repealed if it isn't readopted after 100 people request the hearing.
Senator Scheid, I can understand the 25 people for Chapter 14 for requesting a hearing, but in this instance, it would seem to me that we would want to reference stakeholders, which I believe would be, in terms of their children's education, it would be parents or guardians. And I wonder what you would think upon about changing upon written request of 100 or more people to upon written request of 100 or more parents or guardians of students.
Madam Chair, I really don't quarrel with that. I will tell you, though, that the league and people testifying and people who have contacted me before feel that the community has an interest in the team. In fact, it seemed to me they were almost suggesting ownership, that children, students who transferred were betraying the community that raised them. And so I don't know how the league or those people would feel about that, but I'm fine. I'm kind of making a point here. I think I'm fine with parents or guardians.
I wonder how other members feel, if they have an opinion about this issue, about whether it should be. I'm just looking at what the repealer language is and what else is there. Anybody have a strong feeling about whether that would be more appropriate to say parents or guardians of students, or whether 100 or more people is appropriate? Senator Lori?
I mean, I think that it seems like it would be more appropriate to have some stakeholders, parents or guardians, but I have some broader concerns that I'd like to address before we move too much farther here. I mean, this effectively, 100 signatures, you know, stakeholders or anything, would put every rule that they've ever imposed under, you know, it would nullify every rule they've ever imposed. If you could find 100 people to say, hey, I don't like that rule, or stakeholders, and force them to go through Chapter 14 of the APA the way I read this, and that seems problematic.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I suspect that that's true in any case, that they have their own process right now for rulemaking, and that at any given time, if somebody came forth on all of the rules, one of the rules that I think they might, well, it's a bylaw, actually, but I think,
but
you know, yes.
Senator Lori.
This would actually strike the rule until you could go back through Chapter 14's rulemaking the way I read it. If readoption is required, the rule that is subject to the readoption request ceases to be effective unless the rule is adopted. So, I mean, this would cease the effectiveness of any rule that you could garner 100 signatures on until they went through a rather, you know, I mean, APA is a rather extensive rulemaking procedure. And so I don't know. That correct me if I'm wrong, please.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, be willing to entertain looking at, you know, something that would ease that issue. I don't think that is logically or likely to happen, but I think it's not precluded by the language. I understand what Senator Lori is saying. Frankly, I'm not, you know, I don't want to sit here and mess with my own bill, but I don't like readopt it either. But I didn't write the language. What I want to do is have the league have to go back. Frankly, I hope that 100 people come forth, parents and or guardians, and have them challenge this rule that they've just adopted. That's my axe to grind, if you will, but I think it's a very important one. And if the rule that they adopted was so overreaching into other students' educational programs and careers that I think it's important that they be required to use Chapter 14.
Senator Lurie, then Senator Roebling. Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Scheid. I think that, I too would be much more comfortable if, if it were, they followed the current rules in setting this, and this was brought up and defeated in the Education Committee, the reversing of this rule. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes. Two people afterward told me they really had meant to vote for it. It would have passed. Okay. So that's how close it was.
Okay.
I'm not just making that up. Tell you that, Senator Lurie, Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, it's only effective that rule ceases 1 year after they receive the written request. It doesn't immediately, as I read it, I don't think it immediately.
They have a year in order to go through Chapter 14 again to readopt the rule.
Right.
What I don't see here myself, and then I'll call on Senator Roebling, Senator Scheid, is at what point does the rule stay in effect? And it looks like, so you have 100 people who challenge Rule A, and the league goes then through the process of re-adopting Rule A and does so within 6 months. Well within your year time before it would cease to be effective. What is to prevent another 100 people to file a petition to challenge that rule yet once again right after the readoption and over again? Mr. Bodern?
Madam Chair, I think the key is the first sentence in paragraph B. This subdivision does not apply to a rule adopted before the effective date of this section. The written request refers to a rule adopted. I'm sorry, it's in actually the second sentence. The written request is a rule adopted before the effective date of this section. Once it's been readopted under Chapter 14, it wouldn't be subject to that request under paragraph B.
Okay, so if it's done once, then it is only under Chapter 14. Is that correct? Am I understanding it better now? Mr. Bodern?
Madam Chair, there would be no, once it had been adopted under Chapter 14, there would be no provision for a petition to require readopting it.
Okay. Is that clear to members what my confusion and the resolution of it was? Thank you, Mr. Bodern. Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a different opinion than Senator Scheid, and I'm not looking for this rule to be changed until at least it's been tried for a while, because there is a real problem out there. And I do think the High School League has made a very diligent effort to work with a lot of the stakeholders to try and bring a resolution to their problem. And I'd like to see them have an opportunity to see if this resolution works or not before it's changed. But one of my concerns is that I know that I've often heard that rulemaking is more difficult than passing a bill. And it's also a lot more expensive. And I am wondering how long does it usually take to pass a rule? Can it easily be done within a year? And how expensive is it?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I don't know the cost. I assume it varies. But certainly we know that rules are done in less than a year. Some may take longer, but, I mean, we know that some never get resolved. But
Senator Scheid, I'm going to ask Mr. Bodern if he knows if there is, a time frame for most rules being adopted, let's say when the Department of Health is directed by the legislature to adopt rules regarding foreign adoptions or something. What
Madam,
is there like within 2 months, within 4 months, et cetera? Is there a time period for comment, et cetera, that is general?
Madam Chair and members, given the minimum time requirements in statute, I think it's fair to say that without using any of the expedited processes, it's at least a period of 4 to 5 months. But given the varying levels of complexity, the amount of testimony, the number of stakeholders, the number of hearings required, can be obviously a great deal more than that. I guess I'm a little bit more familiar with some of the small agency rulemaking, and I do know that tends to be considerably faster and cheaper.
Senator Roebling, I think that's as good as we're going to get. Senator Lurie?
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, under the current procedures with the request of 100 parents or guardians, you had to have a hearing before an ALJ. Did this happen for this rule, this public hearing?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I do not know the answer to that, but I do not think so.
Mr. Aronson is going to be testifying, so we can ask him.
Okay.
Any other questions for Senator Scheid? Senator Larson?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Scheid. Just so I clear any confusion I might have about what this bill does to the current rule that the High School League is moving forward with. If this becomes law, it will not repeal the rule that the High School League has brought forward. It'll only put a process in place to essentially require them to go back through a different process, our typical rulemaking process, to readopt where they arrived at, presumably, today. I mean, I think my assumption would be that ultimately they probably would arrive at, through a different process, that same thing. They, you know, Senator Scheid, from my perspective, they may have gone too far. I've not been on the committees that have seen the bill. I was not on the Education Committee. However, I do think they're on the right track. And so my concern is doing anything that harms their efforts. If what we're doing is providing more accountability and making them provide further justification that they've got it right, I'm not necessarily opposed to that. But I want to make sure this isn't going to set back the High School League in implementing what it's come forward with.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I feel I have to address the underlying issue here, if I may, just
certainly,
because that's influencing, you know, people's feeling about this bill. Currently, in the bylaws of the State High School League, there is a provision against recruitment. I received calls from coaches who complained, well, there's this recruiting going on. It's going on at summer camps, summer basketball camps. It's going on in communities. And there's a rule, a bylaw, providing for an investigation, providing sanctions, and even not just for school officials, but also if an individual, say a parent, is found to be doing this maybe a couple times, then they would be considered a representative of the school, and the team would still be subject to sanctions. They aren't using it. If what's happening is that students are being recruited, they have a process. I have maintained from day one, focus on the adult behavior. Do not penalize students who want to come to a small high school in Brooklyn Center, in the district I represent. They want to come out of North Minneapolis. They may come for academic reasons. Maybe they come because they want a chance to play on a basketball team. They're not going to have a chance at Patrick Henry or Edison or North. They might have a chance at a small school. As I said, Brooklyn Center isn't building a sports kingdom. They're not trying to win a championship. They're trying to win a game. They don't have enough people. Of the 34 students out for a winter sport at Brooklyn Center High School right now, over half, 53%, are open enrolled kids. They haven't won very many games. They don't all have uniforms. This rule would say to that student, you can't play for a year. Now, Mr. Aronson will tell you, well, we'll give them a waiver. Or I have three high schools in the district I live in, the Osseo School District. Two of them are considered dramatically racially imbalanced. The district has in place a plan to transfer 150 students from a very racially imbalanced Park Center to the very racially imbalanced Maple Grove and vice versa. They would be precluded from playing under this rule. Oh, but they'll do a waiver. I'm sorry, I don't think that cuts it, and that's why I'm taking this approach now, that a rule should work for the majority of kids, and if it doesn't, then maybe you should go back to the drawing board on that rule so you're not having a negative impact on those kinds of students. And I think there's more of those kinds of students than there are star athletes. And so they have a procedure in place to deal with the adult behavior. I just, one more thing. If you're a parent of a rising star, an athlete, do you think you're going to arrange for the transportation of that student to another district without having some assurance from an adult in that district that that student's going to play? Somewhere, those parents are getting some assurance that that kid's going to play. That's adult behavior. That's where we should be focusing and not going after kids. I think this is pushing kids around when we shouldn't be. We should be dealing with the adults here who are misbehaving, if that's what it is. You know, so that's where I'm coming from. And I think open enrollment, having, you know, it's 20 years of open enrollment, it's pretty near and dear to us here in Minnesota, and I think it's very important. The Commissioner of Education did testify in favor of my other bill. We are concerned. We are concerned for the academic choices and how this can have an impact on a student's choices that may be very appropriate academically, but maybe swimming is going to keep them in school for a year. Maybe playing football is going to keep them in school.
So that's. Thank you, Senator Scheid. Mr. Aronson, do you want to comment on the bill? Senator Scheid, did you have any witnesses?
Madam Chair, no. Okay. I appreciate that you are hearing the bill at this hour.
Absolutely.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Roger Aronson. I am legal and legislative counsel for the Minnesota State High School League, and I have four handouts here that I'd like to give to members of the committee if I could get those distributed. I'm going to give you one,
thank
too,
you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Scheid and I have been working together on this for some time, and I appreciate, and we appreciate working with her on this. Unfortunately, at this stage of the bill, we strongly oppose this bill and would ask that you reject it at this time. I want to talk a bit about the process and why we think this bill shouldn't be adopted. And I will answer some questions about the rule, too, just so that you understand the underlying rule in which has given rise to this.
Truly, as I said to Senator Scheid, the purview of this committee is adopting rules.
Correct.
Not the policy. I think we're all familiar with that. We're asking, our question and our jurisdiction is it proper to ask the Minnesota High School League to abide by Chapter 14? And that's really what we want you to speak to. And
I appreciate that, Madam Chair.
Gave a little bit of latitude to Senator Scheid, but we're not interested in rules of any kind that the High School League adopts under its current procedures. We want to know why it's either appropriate or inappropriate for them to come under Chapter 14.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, let me start out from saying the High School League is actually a nonprofit corporation, and we have 550 member schools. Those are both public and private schools. We have 80 schools that are private schools that are members of the league. We are governed by Chapter 128C, as Senator Scheid has pointed out. There was some litigation that arose in the 70s, and in this committee you would be familiar with the issues of that governmental entities cannot delegate their legislatively directed responsibilities without some specific authority. And so 128C actually authorizes school districts to transfer the regulation of interscholastic athletics to the Minnesota State High School League. That's why we have the statute. There's a significant amount of oversight in that statute. We actually do have a review by the Commissioner of Education every year. We have an annual audit by the state auditor. We abide by the open meeting law. We comply with the Government Data Practices Act, and there are some other rules in there as well. What we thought was a clarifying provision some years ago is a statement in the statute that says the rules of the Minnesota High School League are exempt from the Administrative Procedures Act. We didn't come and ask for an exemption. We're not a state agency in that particular sense, but we wanted a clarification that indeed we would adopt rules in the same fashion that schools do, et cetera, as they govern the behavior of our students. We have, and there's one thing about an eligibility rule, but if you read the Administrative Procedures Act, what constitutes a rule there is much broader than our eligibility rules. And we think we have in excess of 1,500 rules that would come within the purview of this particular legislation. I've provided a letter for you to take a look at from Judge Harvis. As you know, Judge Harvis used to be the director from the Office of Administrative Hearings. He was there for 8 years. Then he was appointed to the district court bench, and he does conduct from time to time some eligibility hearings for us. Judge Harvis does a nice job in that letter of illustrating why the Administrative Procedures Act process does not work for the High School League as well as our current process does. What I wanted you to be aware of, members, is that unlike a department, which has a commissioner and staff that basically make the decisions, the league has a 20-member board of directors. And in addition, and of that 20 members, four of them are appointed by the governor. So we have four public appointees, and then we have the various associations, school size, the school board association, school principals as well, who put people on that board. In addition, we have a governing body called our representative assembly, and I gave you a list of who's on that. These are 48 people from throughout Minnesota, and when it comes to the adoption of rules, the rules have to come up through the grassroots, go through our board of directors, which is 20 members, and then go to the representative assembly. Similarly, if five schools sign a petition requesting a new rule, that would go to the representative assembly as well. It is very important in the focus of this discussion to keep in mind that no one has complained about our current process, that there was anything closed about this, that people didn't get a chance for opportunities. In fact, we set up an ad hoc committee that met on multiple occasions that had folks from throughout Minnesota, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the state that came with a directive. We met with all of the athletic directors in Minnesota. We do that in the fall every year. This then went to our board of directors and then off to the representative assembly where the new rule was adopted last month on a vote of 48 to nothing. 10 years ago, there was some discussion about rulemaking, and maybe it's a cyclical deal, some people have suggested, but the statute that appears that's being repealed here was adopted at that time, and that was that if folks felt dissatisfied with the league process and wanted us to use a judge from the Office of Administrative Hearings, if 100 people signed, 100 parents signed that petition, then we would be in that particular model. You asked earlier if that had happened here, and the answer to that is no. We did not have 100 parents come forward and ask that we do this, but it was done in public meetings, and the representative assembly was a public meeting, as was our board of directors meeting. One of the questions that was raised when this bill was first introduced is, what would the cost be? And we did some discussion with staff about how would we get a fiscal note on this, and it was suggested to us that it would probably go to finance, probably to the Department of Education, and then probably back to us. We did get a reference to the state agency rulemaking manual. The manual itself is 350 pages long. We did excerpt two pages of this for you to take a look at that shows the various costs of the rulemaking here, and that a major rule, the cost projected in this, is in excess of $200,000. We have many rules that have various levels of controversy about them, and that the statute would expose us to readopting them. We frankly do what we believe, and the senator acknowledged this, and we're thankful for that, but we do a very good job overall of keeping the lid on things on all of these topics, so they're not here for you. How many classes of basketball should there be? Are there the private schools should be in? How long should seasons be? How many children should be on a team? All of these issues are matters that we resolve through our rulemaking process. And we're not sure, and I don't want to over-exaggerate this, but this statute could cost us hundreds of thousands of dollars. And obviously, we think that money, and Judge Harvest points that out well in his letter, says, frankly, I don't think you'd get more public input and may very well get less. Our alternative process with the petitions for 100 folks, that actually has not happened. We haven't had anyone come forward and sign that petition and say, let's do this through the Office of Administrative Hearings. But we think we're successful about that, primarily because we do an awful lot of communication with our schools. And I want to end with this, but you have not received a call from a school district to say adopt this bill because the high school league did a bad job or has a bad process. You haven't received that call from coaches or from athletic associations. You haven't received that from parents, and you haven't received that from principals. There has not been, a good case made to change our underlying process. And I respect, Madam Chair, that this isn't the place to redo the transfer rule. Some folks are unhappy about that rule, and there is room for two views on that. It's just the majority view prevailed, and some folks that are in the minority on that are unhappy about it. But this is not the answer to that in any stretch, and we would strongly urge you to lay this over or defeat the bill here, Madam Chair. I'd answer any questions you might have.
Are there any questions or comments from Mr. Aronson or Senator Shy? Did you want to first of all comment, and then we'll take questions from members?
Madam Chair, I did want to verify with Mr. Aronson about the waiver process, and because I find that very it's awkward at best, and I think not appropriate at worst to govern by waiver, to implement a rule by waiver. And one by one, as the instances pop up of situations that I've described, and then they say, well, we'll waiver that. Well, that shouldn't have, I don't think there should be that negative impact on a student and a family in the first place. But I want to, you did say it would be about 275.
Mr. Aronson, would you like to comment on waivers to other rules that the High School League has adopted and how
Madam
common
Chair,
that practice is to rule by exception?
I'll do it quickly here, Madam Chair. One of the goal of the new rule is to prohibit students from what some have viewed as the abuse of open enrollment, transferring solely for athletic reasons. In response to Senator Scheid's concerns and other members' concerns, we did create in this a very simplified waiver process. That if and let me say, students who enroll in ninth grade are completely eligible regardless of what happened. Students whose parents moved are completely eligible. Senator misspoke about the Osseo DSEG plan. Anything schools do internally is up to schools. So districts that have multiple high schools, whatever rules they set for their attendance boundaries, those are up to the schools. But if the student transfers and it's not in one of those types of exceptions, if the principal from the leaving school signs the form and the principal from the receiving school signs the form that this was not an athletic transfer and was in the best interest of the child will be eligible. That was adopted by the High School League at their board meeting last Thursday, and we have prepared a form to that effect. And the illustrative number that we used out of Michigan is they have a similar rule, and that has been their experience. And so we think we're frankly very well geared up to handle those types of administrative matters. We do that routinely, of maintaining that type of documentation. All of you that have had children in schools know that you sign forms every year about High School League eligibility. We maintain all those. We're very good at it.
Mr. Aronson, I'm going to try and keep myself from speaking to the substance of the rule, but I find it curious that you talk about the students violating and abusing the rule rather than the adults abusing and violating the rule. Senator Scheid?
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to say when The new rule is in and of itself still includes intra-district students, but maybe you've done something since. I apologize if you've adopted something since. But the original rule, and as it was actually adopted by that group in March, I think the 16th or 17th, that did preclude the intra-district as well as inter-district, because it just talked about another school. So maybe you've taken care of that. But I didn't mean to misspeak if I did. No, I apologize.
Are there questions or comments for either Mr. Aronson or Senator Scheidt? Senator Larson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the difficulty with trying for us to stay within the boundaries on this is everything's so interrelated as it relates to why we're here discussing readoption of rules is based on a significant problem that I think Senator Scheidt has identified. And I think Senator Scheidt and I sort of end up at different conclusions, yet I think agreeing on some of the points. And I guess I have a question for Mr. Aronson, and I would hope to have just a little latitude in wanting to know, Madam Chair and Mr. Aronson, what is the High School League doing about recruiting? How many investigations has the High School League initiated, and how many penalties has the High School League delivered to coaches who are recruiting?
Mr. Aronson.
Madam Chair, Senator Larson, a couple things about that. I think that the vast majority of the recruiting, at least as I understand it and has been discussed at the league meetings that I've been in attendance at, relates to summer AAU camps and those types of teams and the organization along those lines. We don't have any jurisdiction over those programs. The league used to have significant authority over what happened in the summer. There were significant complaints from parents about that, and as a result, the league was taken out of those. On the recruiting investigations, we've had a few, but not very many, and they've been rather expensive and rather inconclusive. We do have the rules, but the rules, in terms of the recruiting questions, but most of this, and I think I misspoke, and the chair appropriately pointed this out, the most of this occurs from the summer camps and from parents and open enrollment. I mean, is where it comes from. And some of it does come from the coaches as well. We have some jurisdiction to sanction the coaches. In response to one of Senator Scheidt's concerns about this, we have coaches that are required to sign forms every year certifying the eligibility of their students. We added a certification to that requiring that the coaches certify in writing that they have not engaged in recruiting. So the event that we found that out, we could use that for penalizing them as well. So we're interested in doing that as well, but we could do a lot of work on the coaches and still not address the open enrollment immediate eligibility transfer rule.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my children were high school athletes, so I'm pretty familiar with a lot of the rules, and I would disagree with some of them, certainly. And, you know, it would be interesting. I could get, from one school, I could get 100 people maybe to sign a petition against one of their, how many rules did you say you had?
Well, we probably have Madam Chair, I think we have in excess of 1,500 rules when it comes down to it.
Madam Chair, and so there's a lot of potential here for challenges. And to the recruiting issue, I think most of the coaches are not recruiting. I mean, I don't know of any really that have recruited. They know the rule. But you know what happens with the kids is they do go and join these AAU teams. And those teams are comprised of members from a variety of communities. And they enjoy playing together, and they enjoy winning. And then they think, I would like to be with this group during the school year. This would be a lot of fun. And those students often choose to do that themselves and transfer schools basically for athletic reasons, because they have put together a winning AAU team that they would like to keep together. And I know this happens. I mean, it's happened so often that you had pretty much unanimous agreement from your group that we have to do something about it. And so I know that this particular bill doesn't talk about the current rule that's being discussed, but it is directly directed at that, according to admitted by the author. And I think we're opening a big can of worms, and it may not even be just for this rule, but like I said, there There have been other rules that I've been concerned about. I could even say that I didn't like going every year to sit at that parent meeting after I had done it for about 8 years in a row because I had several kids involved. And the rule was you had to go there with your student athlete every year and talk about the drug and alcohol policies. And I'd heard it many, many times and knew the rule very well, but they still make you do it every year. And I guess it's probably a good little reminder, but some people just truly resented it. And we could get 100 people to sign a petition and say, you should look at that rule again. But I just really think that they do have a strong rulemaking process, and it does involve stakeholders. And I just hate to change it right now.
Is there a further discussion or comment? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak on this bill? Is there a motion on this bill? Senator Scheid, there doesn't appear to be a motion available on this bill.
Well, no, Madam Chair, that's fine. I understand. I just hope that I enlightened a few people as to the issue in front of us.
Senator Scheid, I for one agree with you, but not in a position to offer a motion. Well,
thank you, Madam Chair.
You very much, Senator Scheid and Mr. Aronson. Senator Jungbauer, Senate File 2001.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Jungbauer, 2001.
Madam Chair, members, Senate File 2001 is a department bill that's basically clarification, codification, and going through some specific details of language. And it's pretty simple, I guess. You're here to explain it to us.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Wayne Wislosky, and I work with the Department of Administration Real Estate Services Office. And basically what we're doing, Department of Administration and Department of Natural Resources used to share a statute for selling surplus property. A couple years ago, DNR updated their language. I believe it was in the 2005 session. At the time, our language was moved to a separate statute. The updates were not carried that were made to DNR statute, were not made to admin statute. What we'd like to do is have a consistent process for the public that are interested in purchasing surplus property. This would also add some efficiencies to the process as well.
So would you please go through the bill for us?
Certainly. Essentially what we do, if you're going through by section, there was a certification process that required the Commissioner of Administration to certify surplus property by July 1st of each year. Essentially, how we do that is that's an ongoing basis. And so really in practice, that happens throughout the year and wasn't specific to July 1st. We also, the previous process has...
Yes, what I'm asking for, if you would just quickly go through the bill section by section and point out those sections that are the jurisdiction of this committee.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Under Subdivision 1, essentially what we're doing is just changing the numbering because we do go throughout the section. We do delete different provisions. Under Section 2, we're deleting that certification process that I was explaining and essentially having that happening throughout the year. Under Section 3, we're updating the appraisal requirements. That language that's in there currently, it talks about the standards for us hiring appraisers, and what this would do is update that to a current standard and also would make it consistent with the Department of Natural Resources standards. I will go...
Section 4?
Section 4, the terms of payment. Previously, we were required to include an option for a contract for deed for our buyers. That is a provision that's from many, many years ago when it was difficult for interested parties to get financing. Now it's essentially what's required is that the any interested party would get their own financing. Under Section 5, again, it's that contract for deed language. It's a continuation of that provision.
Okay.
And it also does continue the practice that the state of Minnesota issues quit claim deeds when transferring ownership of state property. And then there are sections under Section 6. That's just a clarification that
And the repealers.
And then the repealers. And the repealers are, again, we're deleting that certification process. We're deleting previously when we when the agencies determined that property was no longer needed, the first step was you went to the Executive Council. Department of Natural Resources, when they updated their language, they removed that provision. Over the years that I've been involved, it's been over 10 years, in going through the Executive Council process, there's never been a property that's been presented to the Executive Council that they didn't approve, so that was deemed as an unnecessary step. The other piece is the reporting requirement. Under this provision, there was reporting requirements that happened every 2 years. The Department of Administration, there's a separate statute that requires annually reporting, so we were basically duplicating reports, and so we're eliminating that provision. And again, 16B285 is related to contracts for deeds, and we're eliminating that provision.
Okay, are there questions or comments for Senator Jungbauer or his witness? Seeing none, is there anyone? Senator Roebling.
I just am wondering, when it says that notice has to be posted for 4 weeks prior to a sale.
Which section are you looking at, Senator?
Section 3, it would be.
Section 3.
It said it has to be published in the legal newspaper. Do you have any way to publish this online so that you could have a wider array of readers, perhaps, including, you know, the legal newspaper? Do you do that?
Madam Chair, members, Senator Roebling, we do post our sales online, as does Department of Natural Resources and Department of Transportation. So we do advertise our sales on our websites.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
So that's your practice, and we have never put that in law that you have to do it or anything, but you plan to continue to do that?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, it is not in law, but it is our practice, and we certainly plan to continue to do that. It's a very inexpensive way to get some exposure for the properties we're selling.
Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify either in support or in opposition of this bill? Senator Roebling moves that Senate File 2001, there are no amendments, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Oppose? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Jungbauer. We now have Senate File 1196. This bill is going to be going back to the Health and Family Security, Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee. Senator Jungbauer is going to have a major amendment to it, but it is not in the jurisdiction of this committee. So I've invited him to speak about the bill and to and we will certainly act on it, but the amendment that is under the purview of the other committee will just be discussed and not acted on. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And actually, I do have an 1196A1 amendment. What this would be, since we are going to have a delete all bill, I thought if you wanted, Madam Chair and members, to adopt the A1 amendment, it would be a delete all, and we would only deal with those issues that are under jurisdiction of this committee and then apply the rest of it in Senator Marty's committee.
Certainly. That is certainly agreeable. Senator Lori moves the A1 amendment. This is not an author's amendment, however, so we need to have it explained and discussed. Senator Youngbauer.
Madam Chair and members, Senate File 1196 is actually an issue that I've been working on for the past 5 years and even as a mayor before that. When we have manufactured home communities within the state of Minnesota, as equivalent to any other property, over time land use changes, the issues within cities that these are located change, and the owners of the underlying land want to sell their property. Well, as manufactured housing becomes more and more expensive and becomes a bigger budget item, that puts the owners of the homes in a precarious situation of trying to find a new location for their home. And what Senate File 1196 actually does is puts together the Minnesota Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund. It's a fund both where the landowners and the homeowners put money into the fund, and then at the time any property would be sold or discontinued in use, there would be money to relocate properties or buy out properties. Currently, there's 21 local units of government in Minnesota that have different ordinances on park. They're called park closing ordinances. So when a park closes, there are, within these 21 different jurisdictions, different rules that apply. And what we're looking for here and what the A1 amendment specifically deals with is talking about the public hearing for closure of a park, and also the fact that it would preempt the local ordinances and make a statewide ordinance that is consistent around the state. Within that, we do not want to harm anyone within those 21 jurisdictions already, so there will be a mathematical formula that would allow for, it's not under this committee's jurisdiction, but just for information, that would allow somebody to figure out anybody that would be under one of those other rules, that they wouldn't come out with less than what that local ordinance says. So the mathematical formula on the existing ones would say you would get the greater of this current legislation or whatever was in existence at the time this statute would go into effect. That's kind of the gist of it at this point. There's a lot of people out there that live in manufactured home communities that if the community closes, quite honestly, without building new communities, there's no place to relocate, and especially within the metropolitan area. As a lot of cities grow, they move manufactured home communities out of the city, change the land use, and there's quite honestly no place to put these. So this is a good combination of both sides coming together and saying, let's kind of finish the process statewide so that both landowners and homeowners know what the situation is should the park close, and move ahead on that. And I do have a park owner here. I've got a number of them here, and I'm not seeing people from the other side, but it's been an ongoing agreement to make sure that it's a compromise.
And Senator Youngbauer, once again, you will have an additional amendment dealing with this issue that is more under the purview of the Housing Committee, Marty's committee.
That is correct, because I believe it's a housing finance agency that will actually put together this fund and be in control of the fund at the state level. So it's controlled by an actual state office.
Okay, are there questions? First of all, before we turn to Senator Youngbauer's witnesses of Senator Youngbauer, either in substance or for clarification. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little uncomfortable with preemption laws, and it says that Section 1 to 7 on line 123 of the amendment preempt and supersede any county, home rule, charter, city, blah, 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 ordinances. I would like to see what Sections 1 through 7 are. Where is that? And your comments, I think, were that these are going to be not clear, that whatever current protections they might have under their current local ordinance, these are going to be stronger or better, or why the preemption?
Senator Youngbauer, what do you mean by Sections 1 to 7? What are you referring to there?
Madam Chair.
Part of the statute?
Senator Pappas, it would be Sections 1 through 7. It's hard to do the to not refer back to. Sections 1 through 7 actually give numbers of what would be paid out through this fund for specifically whether it's a single-wide or double-wide manufactured home. It talks about who's eligible to collect and the specifics on the closures. So the preemption is to make a statewide ordinance. Just a
reference. Senator Youngbaum, I'm going to call on Mr. McGowan to explain a reference to sections 1 to 7, which I would have thought would have been to the bill, when we now only have two sections. Mr. McGowan.
Madam Chair, members, sections 1 to 7 refer to the entire delete everything amendment that's going to be considered in the other committee.
This amendment is not correct here.
It's not correct as it sits, but it's the two portions of the larger amendment that are within the jurisdiction of this committee. So
we need to have this amendment drafted to this committee. And certainly preemption of local ordinances is under the jurisdiction of this committee, but we can't have something referring to sections of a bill that we do not have before us, even though we do have the understanding that those provisions or those policy provisions are more in the purview of another committee. This amendment doesn't mean anything because there aren't seven sections of this bill.
Madam Chair,
when you go to the other committee, you can add them back, but right now they aren't here.
Yes,
Madam
Chair, then I would just simply amend sections 1 to 7 to sections 1 and 2, since that's all we have in front of us. And in the Housing Committee, if the committee so desires, they can put the rest of it in there, since we only have the two sections in front of us.
Okay, we're going to modify. Who offered the amendment? Who did I ask to? Senator Lori modifies the A1 amendment on line 123 to strike the words and number 2-7 and insert and
two.
So that it would read sections 1 and 2 preempt and supersede, and then on line 128 we would strike 2-7 and insert and 2. That's just to make sure that the bill that's in front of us is the bill that's in front of us. Senator Pappas.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't see how that makes sense, since Section 2 is the preemption section, so you're preempting it yourself.
Section 1.
Bell plus, I don't think it's really I don't see how we can vote for a preemption when we don't see what we're preempting. So whether it's under our purview or not, I think we still need to see that.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Youngbaum.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, we in essence do see what we're preempting. We're preempting local ordinances that exist in 21 local units of government that we would not, in fact, have copies. We're replacing it with a statute. And, Madam Chair, I would be okay. I don't know if you have another meeting that we could get the rest of the body of the language together where we could still meet the deadlines. I would be happy to come back if we can. What we do have, Madam Chair and members, is Representative Krantz has this bill on the floor, and we both agreed that we're not going to he's not going to pass it off the floor till we have sign off on both sides on the bill. So it is already sitting on the House floor in a whole different form than what they anticipate being able to or they want to pass it on. And so Representative Krantz will have control of that on the House side. And I as well would not try to pass it off the floor until we have sign off on both sides.
Okay. Here's our dilemma. We're trying to respect the jurisdictions of the various committees. We certainly have jurisdiction over preemption of local ordinances. This bill probably should have been kept in the Committee on Health, Housing, and Family Security before it came here so that we could have seen the work that they did that you now want them to do so that the preemption language would make sense, with sense to us. This committee is going to meet tomorrow evening. The Housing Committee is going to meet on Friday. If we sent this bill, as it is, back to the Housing Committee tomorrow, they're not going to meet until Friday. It could come back to us then, but it would then be considered a late bill. And we could act on it at a hearing next week or at some point, and the bill would have to go to the Rules Committee before it could be forwarded to the floor. That's not unheard of. They don't like it, but it's not unheard of. But I share Senator Pappas's unease about acting on a little bit of language that we don't have the whole bill in front of us to which it refers.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Senator Youngbauer, are you still in negotiation on this, or why is it that we don't have the full bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas.
Youngbauer.
When we finished meeting and did final negotiations yesterday, it's really a matter of it's pretty lengthy in trying to get Senate counsel to draft the whole thing. I was under the impression we could get it done today. That's what, otherwise I would have probably canceled the meeting and tried to talk to the chairs and find out how we could accomplish it. So Senate counsel thought this might be a way to deal with what's under the jurisdiction of this committee.
Madam Chair, aren't we meeting tomorrow night?
Yes, we are, 6 o'clock.
And is that?
We have a full agenda.
There's not a. So that's the difficulty. And then there's not a floor session to transfer it to the Housing Committee on for Friday.
There is.
Madam Chair, I believe there may be a floor session on Friday just because we've got committee deadlines and we just have to move bills around. So Friday there may be one. So.
I mean, Madam Chair.
Then the issue, Senator Betzel, is that we have to amend something onto a bill that's not in our jurisdiction. And I...
No.
You know, I complained about that a lot, and mm-hmm. I don't want to do that.
Right.
I see.
Right.
So the only process I see is to send this bill back to the Committee on Health, Housing, and Family Security, which is not having a hearing until Friday. We were not going to be having a hearing after that. We're not meeting on Saturday, which would mean that this becomes a late bill in terms of Senate deadlines. And I apologize for that, Senator Youngbauer, but that's and I certainly would hear it again and send it to the Rules Committee, and they could deal with it as they chose. And actually, we are going to have a hearing anyway sometime next week because we have a couple more confirmations to have.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
I'm not on the Rules Committee. I don't know if anyone on this committee is on the Rules Committee, but it just seems to me that with our change in deadlines and some of the confusion that's arisen and the differences between the House and the Senate, we need a Rules Committee to be somewhat flexible in dealing with some of these problems. You know, I have not been hearing that from the House,
I would agree with you. And I do think that I would make a special request on Senator Youngbauer's behalf for the Rules Committee to hear this bill. So I'm going to ask Senator
I'll move.
Pappas, if she would move, and the bill that we have before us is unamended. Is that correct?
Amended.
Because we have Senator Lori is going to, or who
is sending it back to you?
Senator Lori withdraws the A1 amendment, and Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 1196, no amendments, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Health, Housing, and Family Security.
Well,
Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, if we recommend it to pass, then it won't come back to us.
Yes, it will. Senator Marty will have a request from me for
Well, let's
it to
not
come
recommend
back.
It to pass until we actually see the bill that we're going to be voting on. Let's just send it to Senator Marty's committee and tell him why didn't you
okay.
send it there?
Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 1196 without recommendation be referred to the Senate floor.
Oh, no.
No?
No, I want to send it to housing.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Without recommendation be referred to the Committee on Health,
yes.
Housing, and Family Security.
Yes.
Okay, does everybody understand that process? Thank you very much. Sorry, Senator Youngbauer, you did your best here. All those in favor of Senator Pappas's motion that Senate File 1196 be referred to the Committee on Health, Health, Housing, and Family Security without recommendation. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Senator Brummel.
Sounds like a good thing to do.
Senator Rummel brings us Senate File 1904.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I have an Amendment A3 that I believe is being distributed.
It's not the Committee of Origin, so we need to have the amendment. It's not an author's amendment. We need to have it distributed and explained.
While they're doing that, I'd like to introduce my witnesses. I have with me Gwen Waltz, who is the wife of our congressman, and we have Dr. David Johnson.
Senator Rummel, I'm having difficulty hearing you. If you put the mic closer.
Thank you.
Okay, our jurisdiction is Section 3, as I see it here. Would you explain your advisory group? And the Senator Larson or Vickerman will move the A4 amendment to have it in front of us. We need you to explain it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do I need to explain the bill in general?
Nope, we're just looking at our jurisdiction.
All right.
I mean, it's an advisory group, and we're looking to see that you have abided by our guidelines.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment on page 2, line 26, after the word comma, inserts the director of, and that gives us somebody who is actually appointing the committee. Page 2, line 28, delete the word facilitate and insert the word chair, so the person would not facilitate but chair the committee. And page 3, line 17, on February 16th, 2008, we would like to delete that and insert when the report is filed and draft legislation is submitted.
So, Mr. Bodern, with this amendment, does Section 3 then meet the guidelines that we have been working with regard to advisory groups insofar as you can tell?
Madam Chair and members, there is also one small clarification I wanted to make. Senator Rummel, I've updated, I made a few minor technical changes to the amendment, and it's now the A4 amendment, and I believe you're getting a copy right now.
Thank you.
The only difference would be on page 1, lines 4 and 5 of the amendment, there's a reference to the draft legislation that was included in the earlier amendment. This just puts it within the duties for the advisory group to make it clear that would have to be done. And then on line 6, just clarify the reference to the faculty from the university member to make it a reference to a faculty member. And after those changes have been made, I believe Section 3 meets the guidelines that the committee has established.
Okay, we have the Senator Vickerman motion to amend the bill so that it meets the guidelines, and then you can explain what this advisory group is. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Rummel, what kind of an advisory group is this?
This is an advisory group to address issues and confusion that has arisen around the state report cards. As we know, we have a report card system that many parents and community members don't fully understand. And so the advisory group would help help us all look at a way to report the results in a way that makes sense. Right now, the 5 stars, 4 stars, 3 stars on the report card refer specifically to scores that are on the tests. And many parents take it to refer to the entire performance of schools. So the test is not the sum total of the performance of schools. It's only a part of it. And so the five stars is sometimes confusing. And many times if you've listened to the radio when our good commissioner's on the radio explaining the report cards it's usually around the state fair time, she has to remind people that the five stars do not refer to the whole school. They refer only, you don't make a decision based on the stars, because the stars really refer specifically to just those test scores.
So the advisory group would be meeting to...
They would be meeting to find a way to make the report card clearer to the public, understandable to the public, that it reflects the true nature and quality of the school without in any way jeopardizing the quality and accuracy of the reporting of the scores.
Okay, is there any questions for Senator Rumold? I see she has a couple of witnesses here, but if there's no need to hear from them,
I'll
we don't
the
need
bill,
to do
Madam
that.
Chair.
Senator Vickerman?
I would like to move the bill, Madam Chair.
Senator, first of all, is there anyone who does wish to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill? Not on the policy, but on the advisory group, which is the jurisdiction of this committee. Seeing none, Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File 1904, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance.
That's correct.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Senator Rummel. Before I take the vote on that, I do appreciate your attention to working with me on getting this in the shape so that it passes easily from this committee to the Finance Committee.
And thank you, and thank you, committee members.
Senator Roebling.
I just have to ask a question on what kind of magic can be worked that finance can give this an appropriation yet.
I'm not sure.
As I've said before on those things, hope springs eternal.
Madam Chair.
There is an appropriation section. There is no other place for it to go there. And it's up to Senator Rummel to convince people that this is something that ought to happen. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, and Senator Roebling, Senator Marty and I were just discussing that. Where is Senator Cohen going to take the money from? Which of our bills?
Board of Regents.
We have the Vickerman motion. All those in favor of Senate File 1904 being recommended to pass and being as amended and being referred to the Committee on Finance, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Rum. Okey-dokey. Senator Prettner-Solon. Senator Prettner-Solon brings us Senate File 2161.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, I have an author's amendment, which is a delete everything amendment. It's the A070703 amendment.
We need to have that distributed while it's being distributed, or if it's in members' packets. Okay, it's in their packets. Senator Larson moves that the committee adopt the 0703 delete all amendment to Senate File Number 2161. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Prettner-Solon, if you would now explain your bill.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for giving me the opportunity to present Senate File 2161. This bill was brought to me by the Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors, who represent 650 public and private licensed surveyors across the state of Minnesota. They have been working the past few years to propose changes to restructure Chapter 505 to make it more user-friendly statute in the platting industry. The legislation before you is modeled after other state statutes. It is the product of year-long work of the Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors Board of Directors in consultation with the Minnesota Association of County Surveyors. Both organizations have spent considerable time working on this legislation and have made sure all the members of their organizations have had input into the proposed changes. In addition, last December, both groups spearheaded a meeting with all identified stakeholders to review the proposed legislation and receive feedback. They had representatives from the League of Minnesota Cities, Association of Minnesota Townships, Minnesota Association of County Officers, Association of Minnesota Counties, and the Minnesota State Bar Association Real Property Section in attendance. Since December, they have been working with those organizations that have had suggested language changes, and the amendment today is a result of all comments and feedback that has been received. As a result of their inclusive effort, all parties are supportive of this legislation. And I will now turn over
Senator Prednisol, I wonder if you'd take us through the bill.
Actually, I'm going to do that. I'm going to let my guests do that, Madam Chair.
Okay. We'd like to have a section-by-section explanation, please.
Okay. And the first speaker is Lynn Caswell, Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors.
Mr. Caswell.
Madam Chair and members, first thing I'd like to do is to thank Senator Prednisol for sponsoring
Mr. Caswell, we do need for you to identify yourself for the record.
Oh, sorry. Lynn Caswell,
thank you.
Past president of Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors. Again, I'd like to thank Senator Prednisol for sponsoring our bill. One of the frustrations that we have is have had in the past and currently do is our platting law has grown in fits, I guess I would say, and it's quite disorganized. It's not built on a standard format that a law would normally be constructed. So this effort is to place some organization to the bill, to the law, to modernize the terminology, to add definitions to it, and I'll briefly go through and note some of the changes.
Mr. Caswell, it usually goes quicker if you just take it section by section. Tell us what's in there, and then if we have questions, we can ask.
Okay. Donations. That normally deals with the dedication of easements and parks, although there was no definition in there as to what was actually being donated or dedicated. We've added definition to that.
Okay.
The purpose, we've added, in addition to the existing language in the law, we've added the verbiage to comply with minor subdivision procedures of a local unit of government to encourage more platting rather than long, complicated meets and bounds descriptions. In the definition section, we have basically extracted all of the definitions that are scattered throughout the existing platting law and put them in that section. In the approval area, we have changed the media size to more standard media.
Is that now in Section 2?
I'm in Section 2 approval under plat format. The media size used to be 20 by 30. We've changed that to 22 by 34, which is a standard sheet size for all media. We have eliminated the request for hard shell documents from the statute, mainly because the hard shell material can't be obtained anymore.
Reasonable.
Plat name, there's been some issues in the past over what is the official name of the plat. If there's discrepancies on between the title on the top of the plat and the verbiage in the plat, it's now stated that in the dedication clause, that's the plat name. There was never any... under the ownership interest, there was never any part of the statute that said who actually had to sign it other than the owners. We've added contract for deed vendees and also mortgage holders. Under subdivision 4 boundaries, that's basically no change. There was some language smithing or wordsmithing that went on just to make sure that it said what it was supposed to say. Under subdivision 5, we changed the mathematical closure. It used to say one part in 7,500 feet. Now it says shall not exceed 0.02 of a foot. And I think I'll turn this over to our other guest speaker. Thank you.
If you'd identify yourself for the record, if you'd like to take us briefly through the rest of the bill, that'd be great.
Thank you, Senator. My name is William Brown.
Mr. Brown.
Hennepin County Surveyor, past officer of the Minnesota Association of County Surveyors. Under Subdivision 6, Public Ways, there was a fair amount of talk in our deliberations on this bill about separating out the notion of dedications from donations and how they apply both to parks and roadways, which under the current bill will be regarded as easements. And so the language in Subdivision 6 under Public Ways reinforces the definition of public ways as dedicated and that they are easements for rights of use. Subdivision 7 further discusses easements and defines easements for drainage and utility purposes, and the new language introduced into this section states that they are temporary easements for drainage and utility purposes only, and excluding temporary easements, building setbacks, building floor elevations, and such that should not be shown on the plat. These are regarded to be planning issues, and that issue is relative to the transfer of title to property. Under water boundaries, this is part of 50521 that came out of the old language. It's primarily existing language. It's just reconfigured to be more fluently read. As with certifications, the certifications required by the land surveyor are spelled out more deliberately in this language, but the content is essentially the same, and all need to be consistent with the current signature requirements under other Minnesota laws, such as 326.02, which is the licensing law for land surveyors. Subdivision 10 on surveys discusses a land surveyor's certification, what he's required to do in terms of where he sets his monuments and when he sets his monuments. This, again, is consistent with prior platting law. Subdivision 11, Section 3, much of this has been removed. It's struck in and moved to 50521, Subdivision 3, which we've already reviewed. The new part of this, on line 6.6, talks about minor subdivisions. This was a major consideration in the development of this statute, was to include language that would allow platting authorities in our municipalities and our townships to recognize the ability to use 505 as a vehicle for recording plats of survey for individual properties or for properties that have subdivided under that the municipalities have subdivided under other statutes. They can do minor subdivisions outside of 505, but have been very reluctant to use the platting ability of 505 to actually record their plats. So this gives them an opportunity to read the law and said, yes, this is indeed something we can do, rather than saying the law is silent, therefore we can't act. Under Section 6.16 of, line 6.16 of 505.04, again, it talks about the reproducible copies. As Lynn had stated earlier, the previous law required, in some people's minds, required the use of hard shells. They weren't available, so it put the recorders and the land surveyors in a difficult position. The Section 6 requirements, again.
What did Section 5 do then? Is that just moving around language as well?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Section 6?
Under certified copies, it struck bound in a proper volume, since they're just not recorded that way and stored that way. And again, Section 6 This has all been moved over into 505.021, subdivision 1, and only concludes at 8.19, saying that the map or plat shall be prepared in compliance with 021 with respect to size, the kind of data that's embedded in the plat, and recorded in compliance with 505.04, which defines how the plat is to be recorded.
And then members are directed to the bill as introduced for the repealers, which are 50502, subdivisions 1 and 2, and 50508 as well. And this other language is replacing that. Those provisions.
Senator, yes, that's correct.
Okay, is there any discussion of Senate File 2161? Did we adopt a delete all amendment? We did not.
Yes, we did.
Okay. The delete all amendment has been adopted, so we do have Senate File 2161 as amended before us. Are there questions of Senator Bretner Solon or of the witness? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I see that surveyors use much different language than lots of people. I thought the word in favor of the donee. I don't know if we use it elsewhere in statute, but I can figure out what it means. But like on page 6, when looking at the real estate taxes section, section 4, it talks about official plat, and then copies be labeled copies. Anyway, we read further down, and it talks a couple of times about exact copy. And I just wonder, I assume it's defined somewhere else, but is the exact copy the original, or it's one of the copies, but it's more special than the copies?
Color.
Color?
Yeah. I believe, pardon me, Senator.
Either one, go ahead.
I believe that this may relate back to another statute that gives the county recorder the option of, in the past, when the copies were out for public use, they would become dog-eared and worn and difficult to read. The county recorder could ask the county surveyor to make an exact copy of the original, which was recorded and treasured away in a place where it couldn't be marred or destroyed. So the exact copy would be a certified copy made by the county surveyor in the image of the one that's being held.
Senator Marty, any further questions? No. Then we have Senate File 2161 in front of us. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 2161 as amended? Seeing none, Senator Larson moves that Senate File 2161, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion fails. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair,
Solon,
and committee members.
And your witnesses. Senator Neville. We have four bills left. We will be going a little bit over our time, and I appreciate the members' patience. Senator Neville.
Thanks, Madam Chair. There are three parts to this bill. Sections 1 and 2 deal with some zoning issues. Section 3 deals with the homestead exemption, and the rest of the bill was an initiative from the Real Property Section, State Bar Association. I believe that sections 1 and 2 are the sections that brought the bill here.
Thank you, Senator Neville. If you would perhaps confine your discussion to those sections,
okay.
That would be that would suit us.
Well, I may not need my witnesses then. I brought some witnesses on the rest of it.
That's fine. If people have questions,
okay.
they'll be able to ask them.
Well, Madam Chair, on sections 1 and 2, depending on how the committee would like to handle this, the hearing could be pretty short. I met about an hour ago with representatives of the cities, counties, the townships, and the DNR. They all don't like sections 1 and 2. But we haven't had enough time to come up with some suitable language. Mm-hmm. If the committee would allow me a couple minutes, I'll describe to you what those sections do and why they're in the bill. Was the case of Graham versus Itasca County able to be included in your packets? I think I had my LA send it over and asked to be put in the packets, but yes.
Yes, we have it, Senator Neville.
The sections 1 and 2 are a reaction to that ruling. And what it is that there's a general rule of zoning that if you have a parcel and it's a buildable lot of record, and then the zoning authority, the local government unit, changes the zoning law, those lots are still usually grandfathered in, and they remain buildable lots. What some zoning laws do is they say if the same person owns lots that are next to each other, they force you to combine them. If they're different people that own those two lots, then they're still buildable. And I had a constituent come to me about this. He had purchased one lot in a subdivision that was in a lakeshore area, although it wasn't on the public waters, and he built a house on it. And 4 or 5 years later, he bought the adjacent lot, which was also a platted lot, partly for buffer and for future investment purposes. Then the county decided to change the zoning law, and the new lot that had been platted that was perfectly buildable, if somebody else would have owned it, was about 100 feet, actually, short of being a big enough lot. The zoning law had required a 40,000-square-foot lot. This one was 39,900. It was not buildable. And so under the law, he had to combine it with the other lot. He couldn't sell it separately. And I just thought that was pretty unfair. But then when checking, apparently there was this case, Graham versus Itasca County, that says that common ownership of properties is not a suspect classification that raises equal protection arguments. So if, you know, the government unit only has to have a rational basis to require this common owner to put his lots together, and that's pretty easy to do. They can say that it's for protection of the shoreline. They can say it's protection for health reasons or other building reasons, things like that. And so in my constituent's case, he had paid full value for this lot, thinking it was a buildable lot. Now it's not worth anything except whatever the additional value might be to join it with the lot next door. It had been cut considerably in value. So that was the reason for this subdivision 1 and 2. It would say that even if it was commonly owned, if it was a buildable lot of record before a new zoning law took effect, it remained it. It remained a buildable lot, even if it was the same person owning both. So that's the policy issue that's in place. I can understand why the local governments want to have the ability to force this combination. In particular, that's probably a problem on lots that are substandard, very small, on that are riparian, where you might not have big enough lots for septic tanks to be built on, and so they want to force them to be combined. And so that's where the local government representative said that they would work with me and try to come up with some language. I don't have it today. So I guess I either have to take it out of the bill altogether, because I know that Madam Chair will probably say you don't want me to ask you to let the bill go to the floor like this, subject to an understanding that if I don't reach compromise language, I'd take it out there.
Good try.
Senator Neville, I think it has to go to the Tax Committee.
Tax Committee? Mm.
I think so.
On advice of counsel.
Then, Madam Chair, what I'd like to ask is for somebody to just take sections 1 and 2 out.
Mr. McGowan, is it sections 1 and 2 that would affect in this bill going to the Tax Committee or the other sections?
It is, Madam Chair, it's the other sections. 1 and 2 occasioned it coming here.
Oh, okay.
So Senator Neville, I think we will ask for a motion to delete those sections, send the bill on to Senator Bach's committee, and then you can deal with those issues there.
Okay.
Senator Larson moves that sections 1 and 2 be deleted. All those in favor of that motion? Or is there any discussion?
Well, Madam Chair, there
Senator
is,
Neville.
I'm sorry. There is one other issue that one of my witnesses, may I take up an issue that touches on a local government issue in Section 3?
Sure.
I've got one witness who has raised, maybe I can just have you talk about the issue in Section 3. Identify yourself and raise the issue.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jeff.
Maybe we should act on that motion first, though, and then we can talk
to delete
about
one
section
and two?
Three. Yeah.
That's fine.
Okay. It's a Larson motion to delete sections 1 and 2. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Sections 1 and 2 are deleted. And now we would welcome hearing from your witness on Section 3. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Sure. My name is Jeff Bursell. I'm a bankruptcy attorney practicing in Minnesota.
Okay.
I represent consumers in Chapter 7 and Chapter 13 bankruptcies. Myself and my firm, we've represented over 25,000 people in this state. The issue with the senator's bill that I have and many bankruptcy practitioners and other consumers in the state is the ambiguities from a outdated law. The law talks about a laid out and platted portion of a city. Unfortunately, case law has come down to just about any homestead in the state can almost be reasonably put into the city category. I'm faced with a lot of people who don't have money or the resources to fight a bankruptcy trustee in this matter. The issues come down to how the judges have interpreted a laid out and platted portion of a city. They look at, one, the nature of the land and what is around it. Unfortunately, with annexations, with what are called rural developments, where you have a bunch of homes in one area, they're clearly out in the country. They have 1.5 acres by the covenant that they buy into, and they're only limited to 1.5 acre. The trustees will force this issue and either force my clients to either fight them in court and potentially lose part or all of their homestead by sale, or come up with some sort of settlement. And it doesn't protect Minnesota homes like it should. My careful looking at the language of it, it simply should be just deleted, keeping it simple, taking out a section after, if I may read what I would propose that the law should read, that the homestead shall include any quantity of land not exceeding 180 acres. The amount of the exemption per homestead, whether the exemption is claimed by one or more debtors, may not exceed $300,000, or if the homestead is used primarily for agricultural purposes, $750,000, exclusive of limitations set forth in 510. The problem is, of course, the laid out platted portion of the city is being interpreted to being a lot of rural areas, and those areas that are covered by really close to a city, and even within some cities now.
Senator Neville?
Well, Madam Chair, I have Mr. Dunleavy next to me with the State Bar Association Real Property Section. We discussed making some changes to this area that would basically delete out this acreage limitation within platted areas. It really isn't necessary because the real confining aspect of this is the dollar figure. So it shouldn't matter if it's a half an acre, an acre, or 5 acres. The homestead exemption under this bill would be $300,000. And so I think I would be inclined. I think Mr. Dunleavy didn't think it would that it would be a good change as well. Am I correct? Yeah. That it would be a good change.
You have an amendment, Senator Neville.
I can do it orally. I don't have it in writing.
Mr. McGowan, are you prepared?
Could I give a shot at it?
I'm prepared.
It's a real simple oral amendment.
Senator Larson will move this amendment. If you would tell us what it is, and please go slowly.
I will.
We don't want to make any mistakes.
Page 3, line 4, after 160 acres, put a period and delete the rest of the line. Delete the entire line, 3.5. and delete 3.6 up to the word the.
Period.
Okay. That's it. Mm-hmm. So the new language, if this amendment was adopted, would say the homestead may include any quantity of land not exceeding 160 acres, period, the amount of the exemption per homestead, et cetera, may not exceed $300,000 or $750,000.
I think that's fairly straightforward. Is there any discussion on the Larson Amendment? Seeing none, we've already heard it explained. Seeing none, all those in favor of the Larson Amendment as read to us by Senator Neville and it's clear to council, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion on this bill? Is there anyone who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition? Seeing none, Senator Larson moves that Senate File 794, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? No. I mean, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
It passed. So, the motion prevails.
Madam Chair, may I ask, did you get in the request for taxes what the tax issue is?
Madam Chair, in closer review, this is not the homestead exemption for tax purposes. It's for debtors' purposes. It may not need to go to the tax committee after all.
So,
I don't know that it's a tax issue.
Right. Senator Larson moves that the motion by which Senate File 794 was recommended to pass and be referred to taxes be now reconsidered. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Larson moves that Senate File 794, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Council and Senator Neville. Okay. Senator Bach, I think you're next. Senator Bach brings us Senate File 2057, Airport Authorities.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, what this bill does is gives the power to create a local airport authority to multiple governmental units. Currently, a city,
why would this be a good thing,
county, or town. This allows a small city like the one I live in, Cook, the opportunity to add some additional township governmental units to their airport authority, and consequently in small towns be able to generate a little additional tax revenue from willing other governmental units to run an airport.
Okay, would
That's
you
really
just
about the extent of it. I have one witness here from the airport in Bemidji.
Could you just quickly go through what each section is so that we have that in front of us? Because I think the whole bill is under our jurisdiction.
Madam Chair, Section 1 just adds airport authority to the meaning of municipality when it comes to creating an airport. Section 2 just talks about their general powers being the same as in other, other municipalities. Section 3 is a definition of who the members of the airport authority might be, and it includes, could potentially include an Indian tribe or band. And actually, I got a call from the tribal chairman from the Boys Fort Band today expressing support for this. They'd like, they would like to participate in the situation of Cook.
Take care of Indian.
And it becomes a joint powers agreement.
Correct.
Though. Is that correct?
Correct. Mm-hmm. And that's what Subdivision 2 makes it clear that they're willing governmental units that participate. Subdivision 3 talks about the commissioners, a minimum of 5 commissioners on the authority. Subdivision 4, how the commissioners are appointed. Subdivision 5 makes it clear that they don't receive any compensation but are entitled to expenses, talks about regular meeting schedules, quorums, the fact that they have officers of chair, vice chair, secretary, and treasurer. Subdivision 6 allows the airport authority to add additional governmental entities and additional commissioners. And then Subdivision 7, if one of the governmental units wants to get out, provides for a decrease in the number. And then Subdivision 8 is a process of dissolution. And Section 4 is the levy to annually certify to the county assessor or assessors, if it's multiple counties, of the mill rate that they'd like to levy across all the different governmental jurisdictions.
Senator Bach, you set up the commission and provide for the appointment, as far as I can see. I'm looking back at like our guidelines, and you, even though this is not the same kind of thing, and set for the length of their appointments, their terms, how to fill vacancies, compensation, establishing a regular meeting schedule. What I'm trying to find is, even though you have officers, who may convene the first meeting of this commission? I don't see how they get together for the very first time, and I was wondering if you could find a point in here where some single authority could be authorized to convene the first meeting, and then from there the group, the commission, would elect their chair or vice chair.
Madam Chair, I wonder if maybe we'd need a little clarification on line 1.2.
Line 1.
1.2, where it says a city that owns an airport by joint resolution.
I don't see a line 1.2.
On page 1.
1.20.
1.20.
Oh, 1.20.
It says real
the building. I think it implies there that the city owns the airport.
You know, what, and that might
maybe
actually
we need a little
be
clarification
what
right
you
there.
Could put there is that, okay, that a city that owns an airport by joint resolution together with any other willing governmental units may create an airport authority that is authorized to exercise its functions upon passage of a joint resolution by each of the governing bodies, including who may convene the first meeting of this commission. That way, the joint resolution, everybody would agree by the joint resolution who would be the convening person. Mr. McGowan,
does that
work for the purposes of clarifying how it can get going?
Madam Chair, that would work. The resolution would include.
Okay, so we have Senator Larson on page 2.2. Before the period, insert including
a proposed meeting date for the first meeting of the authority or the commission.
Including a proposed meeting date for the
first meeting of the
for the
authority.
First meeting of the authority, and then we don't have to worry about a convener, perhaps. Is that correct, or should we say who should including who may convene it?
Madam Chair, but it would be
either way.
The simple process would just be to set a date in the resolution, and then the election of the officers would take place, and further
okay,
meetings
including
would be
setting
scheduled.
A date. So, Mr. McGowan, would you read that back to me, please?
Madam Chair, the amendment would be on page 2, line 2, before the period, insert, comma, and conclude, including a proposed meeting date for the first meeting of the authority, period.
Senator Bach?
That's fine, Madam Chair.
Okay. We have Senator Larson's motion before us to amend this proposal starting on page 2, line 2. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion of this bill? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Bach, I'm just wondering in Section 4 when it says that there would be taxes levied against all real properties within the boundaries of the airport authority, that would mean that all of the townships and cities or whoever would be involved would be taxed to help pay for the acquisition and upkeep of the airport, or what are we talking about there? Well, who's going to get taxed?
I'm sure Senator Bach. I think that's the intent in this a kind of a special taxing district like that. A lot of rural areas have special taxing districts for ambulances, for hospitals, for a number of different things, where kind of a region uses a city-owned facility and the outlying townships are willing to participate in helping pay for that regional service like an airport or a hospital or an ambulance. And this, I mean, it makes it clear in the bill that it's willing governmental units. So, I mean, nobody's being forced into it. But if a township government decided they wanted to be part of a city's airport authority, this would give them the opportunity to do that. And they wouldn't, I'm sure, enter into that without knowing what their tax liabilities are. It's not that uncommon.
Senator Roebling?
So you plan to have these airports pretty much self-sufficient, that they would be dependent upon whatever revenues they could collect from the users of the airport, and I mean, pretty much like MSP maybe, which has an authority to levy. In the end, they don't, but they do have that authority. But will we be looking at bonding requests here to acquire property and get the operations going? I'm a little concerned about what we might be starting.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Bach.
I think these airports are already in place, and in small rural areas, they're just trying to find a way to get some additional participation by kind of outliers that are willing to participate but under current law can't.
So it gets a critical mass to really operate them all.
Really makes them, I think, brings the operation of a more in line with what their current function is. They serve a regional purpose, but it's a small group of people that have to participate in the actual funding of them. I think if outlying governmental units are willing to do that, we should, that's the kind of cooperation we should be encouraging.
This bill does need to go to the Tax Committee. I do find it very curious on line 3.7 that you use the term mill rate, which we seldom use anymore, but you can take care of that in the Tax Committee. I think we call it the tax rate.
I think, Madam Chair, that probably
mill rate.
Will be changed.
That's like 20 years ago, Senator Bach.
Well, Madam Chair, you'll notice this wasn't drafted by Senate Counsel. I'm sure Senate Counsel would have had that accurately.
Yes. Well, we'll let you take care of that in the Tax Committee. We do have Senate File 2057 before us as amended. Senator Bickerman moves that Senate File 2057 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill? Senator Roebling.
Chair, I just have one question. Since this is public money that will be used for these purposes, does it fall under general auditing requirements by saying that the municipality includes an airport authority? Does that automatically make it fall under our state auditing rules?
Mr. McGowan.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I don't believe so. It's a municipality for purposes of Chapter 360 only, and I'm not sure exactly what statute it is that requires the auditor to audit local governments, but it wouldn't necessarily require an audit by the state auditor. It might, but it doesn't automatically, mm-hmm. because it's defined as a municipality in Chapter 360.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Senator Bach, that might be something you want to look at because these are public dollars, and I know that we're bringing in like watershed districts under the state auditing statute now, and it kind of depends on what their revenues are, what their tax revenues are, how often they need an audit, and it might be only once every 5 years. But if they're involving more money, over like $160,000 a year, it would probably be greater than that. More frequent audits. So I think it's important that we have some language in there.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I think that's a good suggestion, and we'll certainly do that when we get the taxes.
Thank you.
Is there further discussion on Senate File 2057 as amended? Seeing none, Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File renews his motion that Senate File 2057 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. Everyone in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion fails. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Bach, is Senator Chaudhary here?
He had to step out for a minute to go back to his.
Senator Dahl. Welcome to the committee. You're very
Thank
patient,
you.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Glad to be here. I know we're running late, so we'll try to keep all of our comments pretty short, but I brought a few mayors with me to kind of talk about this issue here. This bill is about changing the composition of the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and we all know the economic strength that airport gives us here in our economy. But as the airport has grown and the city has grown around it, the amount of traffic that this airport has really should have an airport that's twice the size that it is, its footprint. And so it's really affecting a lot of neighborhoods right around the airport itself. And now with the addition of the North-South 1735 runway, that's now starting to impact cities south of the river, like Burnsville, Apple Valley, Eagan. And cities like Bloomington and Richfield and Mendota Heights have been dealing with this issue for years. And it's about air pollution, noise pollution, reduced property values, safety concerns as well. And what we'd like to see is take a look at bringing more mayoral representation into the Metropolitan Airports Commission. So with that, I'd like to I've got the mayors of Richfield, Bloomington, and Apple Valley. I think we'll start off with Mary Heyman Rowland first from Apple Valley, just to speak briefly about why we'd like to see a change here.
Good evening, Chair Rust. And
you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Yes, I will. My name is Mary Heyman Rowland, the mayor of Apple Valley, and it's an honor to be before you today. I know that Senator Rust is a very pragmatic individual, and I very much appreciate your here today, as well as your colleagues. When I first became mayor 9 years ago, the kinds of calls that I would get from our citizens were about dogs barking, or maybe teenagers maybe having some fun on a Saturday night, or perhaps an occasional motorcycle. But my life has changed since 1735 has opened. And while I understand that the airport is an important economic driver for our state, and I very much appreciate the cities that have had the noise before the city of Apple Valley, many of the citizens who moved from Bloomington and Richfield have come out to Apple Valley, the quiet place where you hear an occasional dog barking. Today, I get calls on a continuous basis about airport noise. The impacts on our community are growing month to month. For instance, in March 2007, this last month, departures off of runway 17 more than doubled compared to March 2006. The runway is now handling more than one-third of all departures from the airport, and therefore the communities south of the airport need and deserve a greater presence on the MAC. And I state this as well for the city of Bloomington and city of Richfield, but also the cities of Burnsville. I want to keep my remarks short, but you know that life has changed for us. And I believe that as mayors, we will be there to make pragmatic decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
Senator Dahl.
Senator Dahl, your other witnesses, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Debbie Gotay. I'm the mayor of the city of Richfield. And I want to thank the senator and the members here for allowing us to come here to testify. You probably know that Richfield is probably the most highly impacted city from the airport. We've lost homes to the expansion of the city. And the noise that we experience, the overhead noise, we also experience a rumbling noise that's called low-frequency noise. That's noise that's far different than some of the noise that impacts other cities. This noise actually impacts the homes, the types of buildings we have. It makes them unlivable. These are the things that we are dealing with right now. Mrs. Halverson is one of my residents who lives in one of a half dozen houses that is closest to the north-south runway that Mary spoke of. Mrs. Halverson lived there now for 60 years with her husband. He's now since passed away. And she has called many times about the issues of the home and the idea of whether she will have to move or not. And she is greatly saddened by this because this is the only home she's had since her married days. The Happertaffys were another family who were already displaced by homes that were taken in Richfield. And I remember talking to Jean as I stopped by door knocking, and I remember her crying and talking about the home that they had left that they had also bought when they were married. But you know, the residents of Richfield are actually pleased and want to be a part of an expansion of the airport. They realize that this is good for the entire regional area and that this makes economic sense. We're just looking for our fair share of what's going on. We're looking for the mitigation we need so that we can continue to be a viable community and so we can enjoy quietude, the quietness of things. Council member Bill Killian, who could not be here today, has moved his bedroom to his basement so that he can sleep at nights. These are the impacts. These are the calls that I get. These are the people in my residence who come to me and say, be my voice. I can't be their voice if I don't have a seat at the table. So I need a seat at the table so at least they can understand the great impact that we have here. And I know that there have been two bills that have come to the House version of these and that they're looking to table them to talk to these communities. And I encourage you as well to please look at this as well because it's not just the 65 DBL now, which was a delineator before in the Messer bill. The cities of Apple Valley now are experienced because some of the flight patterns have changed. I think it's really key that we get a very solid piece of legislation that can be passed and that we have a delineation of what cities should be in and what should be out. Because otherwise, if we water this down, we will not have something substantive that will be voted on. So I very much support this, and I hope you can understand the impact that we're seeing in a community such as this. Bloomington's experiencing very similar. So is Apple Valley. So is Mendota Heights. So is Minneapolis. So I hope you can understand where we sit.
Thank you very much. Senator Dahl, your other witness?
Gene Winstead from Bloomington, and then we'll try to wrap this up.
Good evening, Madam Chair. Thank you. Gene Winstead, Mayor of the City of Bloomington. And I think Mayor Hammond-Roland and Mayor Gotell have spoken about some of the issues that have been raised regarding and specifically to some of the noise concerns. And yes, City of Bloomington does have and do, you know, has those same concerns and issues also. But I think that when it comes to the governance model of the airport and the Metropolitan Airport Commission, I think that I can shed a little light and add a little to it. I would contend that the airport actually extends physically into the City of Bloomington. The City of Bloomington has lost land and building and development. It's been removed to accommodate the federal safety zone for the new runway that's there, as well as there is some other limited development that's only capable now because of the state safety zone that goes into play. As well as from the City of Bloomington's perspective, we have a lot of other interaction with the airport and how it is run and governed. You know, we share a public training safety facility. The City of Edina, Bloomington, and the airport, as well as Eden Prairie, have helped fund and share that. We right now are going to be conducting a study with the Metropolitan Airport as well as MnDOT regarding 494 and possible expansions and uses and interchanges along 494 that are there. And our city, too, is one of the first responders for any emergencies that happen in that area. And we have joint powers agreements, and we will work and help with the airport. So there is greater ongoing relationship with the airport, and I think that representation regarding its governance model could and would be useful and beneficial, really, for the overall operation of the airport. And I think, too, one of the things to be considered looking at this and in adding seats might be to kind of look back at history and figure out why it is configured the why it's configured the way it is. And if you go back into history, and I don't know if you care to, and I don't pretend to be much of a historian when it comes to this, but why the City of Minneapolis and St. Paul have appointed seats or their own seats on there. And it really goes back to when the airport was turned over in 1943, and they were the owners of the Minneapolis Airport and the St. Paul Airport, and how they were going to jointly go together, and they had turned their assets over to this new governance body called MAC. But And then as you look at that, too, the configuration of the board was enlarged back in the mid-90s when the dual-track process was underway, and they were trying to figure out and make some very large decisions, and I think it was prudent to get some outstate representation there, and so the governor and the legislature added four seats when they were going to be making some big and financial decisions going forward about what to do with an airport, whether to relocate it, and there were some impacts. Well, the dual-track process was shut down, and those seats remained on. And at one point in time, I think there was conversation about even removing those seats again. But when it comes to relationship and reasons for, I think that some of the reasons I've stated could give cause and pause to consider, you know, this type of action in order to have seats on that representative board of the airports.
Okay, questions for the witnesses or for Senator Dahl? I will explain to the members that I would like someone from the MAC who's present to come forward, whoever is here, just briefly. Just a second, please. I have spoken with Senator Dahl. We understand that the companions to this bill have been laid over in the House. I wanted to give him an opportunity to present the bill. The House is going to be undertaking an interim study of the whole issue in terms of accountability and oversight of the MAC governance structure. I wanted our committee to be aware of that, and we will be working with the local government committee in the House to decide and discern how just what will be this joint to the extent to which it will be a joint effort and a joint review. So I just wanted to let members know that. Senator Larson, did you have a comment then?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm disappointed that the House laid the bills over, I think. Frankly, and that, I guess my question was going to be clarifying in that I thought I was hearing a couple of things. It sounded like Mayor Hammond-Roland was asking to lay over, and I know that it sounded like the other mayors were really ready to go forward. And I think there's general agreement that this representation is necessary. And so, you know, I can tell you that after another year of sitting around and talking about it will result in those communities wanting their voice heard at the table. I would also, for the second time this year in this committee, raise the issue that the Metropolitan Airports Commission or the governor's office, and I've asked for information. Let me back up. It was during Senator Betzel's budget committee, that I asked this question and still have not gotten an answer about why the communities that I represent, Richfield and Bloomington, still don't have a voice on the Metropolitan Airports Commission. We have had a vacancy now for quite some time. We had one of the largest public expenditures to a private company in the history of probably Minnesota as it relates to the discussion with the MAC and Northwest Airlines. And all that discussion occurred without our communities having the voice at the table under current law. And so it's a matter of enormous frustration that we have difficulty having the voices heard in that body. I just want to commend Senator Dahl for bringing this forward. And the mayors and city councils who support moving forward now, even though I understand the House is not moving forward, and hope that we may continue to look for opportunities this year to still move this forward. This is not a new idea. I think I had a similar bill like this in 1999. We've been talking about this for a long time. The problems continue to affect the residents, and so I hope at some point we just act on the policy proposals. And I understand we're in the position where if we pass this bill, because it's not met deadline in the House, it essentially dies as well. So it's not a fault of this committee's. But it would be, Madam Chair, I appreciate you allowing me to share my frustration with this committee, not only about our inability to move this bill forward, but about our state government's inability to provide representation under current law to the residents that are in my district because we can't get an appointment to the Metropolitan Airports Commission. And my district isn't the only district that's being affected by this. There are two seats that have remained open for quite some time now, and we're darn frustrated by it.
Thank you, Senator Larson. We do have another committee coming in here, and we have one bill left. Senator Metzen, if you would be so kind as to indulge us for a very short time. Mr. Killian, I do see you there. I'm just going to address you informally that we are going to be having conversations with the House, and we hope that the representatives from the Metropolitan Airports Commission will be joining in those conversations as we discuss representation on the MAC board. Thank you very much, Senator Dahl. Mayors, Senate File 482 is laid over.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you,
you
very
Senator
Dahl. Thank you, Dan. Senator Chaudhry, we are due to be out of here, so I'm sorry to rush you.
No problem, Madam Chair.
This bill is here because of a rulemaking authority. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Our jurisdiction is Section 2 and not the policy.
Correct, Madam Chair. The Environment Committee unanimously voted in favor of the ability of the Environmental Quality Board to adopt rules that require an environmental impact statement regarding genetically engineered wild rice.
Okay. Is there any questions that the members would like to ask about Section 2 and the proposed rulemaking authority for which board is this?
Environmental Quality Board.
The Environmental Quality Board. Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, I had an amendment. I'd like to ask you to consider indulging. The committee had planned, his Senator Chaudhry's committee had intended to do this. I believe it's purely technical amendment to page 3. It's being handed out now, the A4 amendment.
The A4. We have the A4
and
amendment.
And I don't believe there's any opposition to it. I think this was intended to be put on there, but
that's what I understand as
I'd like to move that if that's okay.
Senator Marty, Senator Chaudhry, you're aware of the A4 amendment?
I haven't seen the actual language of it. What does it do?
It is deleting on page 3, line 4, identified and inserting potential, and then on page 3, line 5, deleting genetic and inserting genetically engineered.
That's correct.
This was an amendment. We are offering it here as a courtesy. It was meant to be included in the Environment Committee. We know how that happens in our committee. Senator Marty moves the A4 amendment. Is there any discussion of the A4 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there any discussion over whether the Environmental Quality Board should be given authority to adopt rules? Senator Roebling.
Well, Madam Chair, I know this money issue isn't supposed to be a concern of ours, but who pays for the EIS?
Beg pardon?
Who would pay for the study that we would be ordering through this legislation?
Senator Chaudhry.
Madam Chair, the EQB.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling?
Senator Chaudhry, is that something that they frequently do? Do they have money in their budget for it? There isn't really an appropriation here. I'm just wondering. I know EISs are quite expensive.
Madam Chair, it's my understanding that that this may have to go to finance.
Is there further discussion of Senate File 2103 as amended? Seeing none, Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File 2103 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there any further discussion of that motion? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill? For the rulemaking authority section only. Okay. Please identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Sandvig. I'm here on behalf of Life Science Alley. Life Science Alley is a merger between Medical Alley and MinBio. We represent the medical device as well as the biotech industry in the state, and I know the hearing is late. I just want to say that our concern with Section 2 is the rulemaking authority. That's the part of the bill that we object to. We are not aware of anybody that's looking at genetically modified wild rice. Our concern with this section and giving rulemaking to that, in particular with the amendment that you added to the study, would be looking at that as a potential. And as I said, I'm not aware of the – and I spoke to the university after the hearing yesterday that nobody is looking at doing this right now. Our concern is with the rulemaking, you're changing the process for this one kind of agricultural crop, and it sends a message as far as to the biotech as far as a different kind of process. And we are concerned that if you do this for one, this will be kind of the camel's nose under the tent as far as looking at other crops potentially. GMOs can be emotional in looking at that, and our concern is the kind of message that Minnesota might send. That's our concern.
Thank you, Ms. Sandvik. Is there further discussion or comment?
Madam Chair,
from the public, seeing none, Senator Vickerman moves, renews his motion that Senate File 2103, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? No. The motion prevails. There being no further business before this committee, we are adjourned. Thank you, Senator Metzen.